Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Gentlemen, what brings me to my next point? Don't smoke crack.
Mike, no doubt this case has gained international attention. And finally, tomorrow, Gorilla World will reopen with some new barriers after this little boy fell into that exhibit. And just today, his mother was not charged with any wrongdoing, even though some people blamed her. A curious little boy scampered away from his mom and ended up face to face with a 450-pound gorilla, Harambe.
Oh my God!
Isaiah, be calm! Be calm! Be calm! Be calm! He's dragging my son! I can't watch this!
The prosecutor decided the child's mother was not careless. Joe Dieter says, according to four witnesses, the three-year-old was so quick to dash through a barrier, some bushes, then down 15 feet into the gorilla enclosure. His mom still had her back turned, taking care of other children.
For instance, had she been in the bathroom smoking crack and let her kids run around the zoo, that'd be a different story. But that's not what was happening here.
You smoke crack, don't you?
Perhaps they couldn't put their crack pipes down.
Don't you smoke crack?
Run that shit the fuck back.
For instance, had she been in the bathroom smoking crack and let her kids run around the zoo, that'd be a different story. But that's not what was happening here.
The mom has been a target of outrage for the zoo's decision to shoot and kill Harambe to save the child's life. But Dieter says, as tragic as Harambe's loss is, he shudders at the thought, had the zoo not taken action.
Had they not acted, and this animal behaved sometimes like animals behave, we could have had a genuine tragedy here.
To prevent this from happening again, new, higher 42-inch barriers will be in place when Gorilla World reopens Tuesday.
They're genuinely heartbroken about what happened.
And the prosecutor believes the changes to the barrier will prevent anybody else from getting in. But, of course, only time will tell. Reporting live from the Cincinnati Zoo, Tammy Mutasa, WLWT, News 5.
Now I really understand.
Banks was wrongfully convicted of rape and as a result spent 5 years of his life behind bars. Banks was a 16-year-old high school student, football star courted by big-time colleges in 2002 when another student at Long Beach Poly High accused him of rape, although his accuser admitted 10 years later that she made up the sexual assault. So he was asked to chime in about this. And remember, he served 5 years behind bars as a result of this wrongful conviction, right? Now, I have to note that he pled no contest because he was worried that a jury would wrongfully convict him and he'd be sentenced to 41 years behind bars. Now, here's what he had to say about Brock Turner, this former Stanford University student who raped an unconscious woman behind a dumpster and only got 6 months in prison as a result. He says, I would say it's a case of privilege. It seems like the judge based his decision on lifestyle. He's lived such a good life, and he has never experienced anything serious in his life that would prepare him for prison. He was sheltered so much that he wouldn't be able to survive prison. What about the kid who has nothing? He struggles to eat, struggles to get a fair education. What about the kid who has no choice, who is born to and has drug-addicted parents or a non-parent household? Where is the consideration for them when they commit a crime? I wasn't physically raped, but I was raped in a sense of my freedom. I was kidnapped, taken against my will, placed in a box for 5 years and 2 months. I was denied all human rights. When I screamed and pleaded and begged, it fell on deaf ears. It's a different form of being assaulted and taken advantage of. I know what she, meaning the victim of Brock Turner, is going through. And I think that Brian Banks makes so many powerful points, especially because he wasn't just robbed of 5 years of his life. He was robbed of his entire future. This was a guy who was going to be a football star, and it was all ripped away from him. And it was because he didn't get the same benefit of the doubt that someone like Brock Turner got.
Banks said that when he was being sentenced, instead of the judge empathizing with him, as Brock Turner's judge did over and over again, he said it was like he was ordering McDonald's at a drive-thru window. Oh, you're a poor African-American kid? Who cares? Off you go. Now, isn't that interesting that Brock Turner faced at most a 14-year sentence? Prosecutors chose not to even go for that. They chose to go for only a 6-year sentence. You know what Brian Banks faced? A 41-year sentence. Mm-hmm. So now, facing a 41-year sentence, what did they do?
They had him.
They pressured him and pressured him and said, you're going to lose the rest of your life. So he pled no contest, which where he doesn't admit guilt, okay, but they put him in prison anyway. Mm-hmm. They gave him 10 years. Now, on the other hand, we got a guilty plea from Brock Turner, 6 months. 10 years, 6 months.
I don't know if he pleaded guilty.
Oh, the Brock Turner.
Brock Turner. We don't know if he pleaded guilty,
no,
but
I'm sorry,
he was convicted. He was convicted.
We have a conviction.
Yeah.
So, but by the way, convictions, if you fight it, are supposed to be a longer sentence.
Absolutely.
If Banks had fought it, he would have gotten 41 years.
Yes.
Turner got 6 months. Now, you say, well, you know, Banks, it turns out, didn't do it, but, you know, maybe the situation of that rape, when they thought he did it, was worse. How much worse could it be than raping an unconscious woman behind a dumpster?
And then trying to run away as soon as two witnesses catch you. I mean, it's...
If it was consensual, why are you running away?
That's exactly right. And look, we know that there's a two-tier justice system, partly because judges will treat certain people from a higher socioeconomic status differently, and partly because those from a socioeconomic status like Brock Turner's have the ability to hire the best defense attorneys, right? But I think the bigger issue here is just the fact that we've accepted a system that gives people benefits because they're wealthy. We give people a pass or excuses because they're wealthy, like the affluenza teen, right? Oh, well, you know, he's so privileged that he can't learn from his own consequences. So as a result, we're giving him a pass. This guy, oh, well, he wouldn't do well in prison. It would be really difficult for him. So we're going to give him a pass. When has privilege become an excuse to behave criminally, violently?
Yeah. So it's funny you say that. I was going to bring up the same exact case because the judge's remarks reminded me of the affluenza kid. Well, since he's become accustomed to this rich lifestyle, mm-hmm. oh, prison wouldn't, you know, might be too tough for him. So we'll do county jail and we'll do it for 6 months, but he could actually get out in 3 months for
right.
time served. So, well, okay, so what, the rich people, because they're accustomed to already having a life that's awesome, mm-hmm. we have to continue to give them that life, even if, in the case of the affluenza kid, because of his drunk driving, which was brazen and outrageous, mm-hmm. four people died. In this case, you've got a conviction on rape, but on the other hand, they're accustomed to being rich. So shouldn't we treat them with kids' gloves? And even though, by the way, he's not a kid, he's 20 years old, whereas kids from inner city are getting adult sentences, actual kids, 14-year-olds, etc. I mean, you can see it. The hypocrisy is so stunning that it's amazing that they can't see it. They're so blinded by their bias. They're like, yeah, it's a Stanford kid. What are you talking about? Oh, it'll hurt his reputation. He's already so badly punished. Oh, it's a black kid or a poor kid? Let's go. I got a lot of cases to get through. Here, go. Decades, and I'm moving on. I don't give a damn about you. You don't look like my son at all. He looks like my son. There, but for the grace of God, knows, goes someone I give a damn about. You don't look like the people I give a damn about at all. Off you go to prison, and I don't give a damn what happens to you in prison. But when it comes to someone I empathize with, oh my God, what'll happen to him in prison? Just try to have the same level of empathy for everyone. Shouldn't be too much to ask for in a democracy.
You have any idea what a burden you people are on the taxpayer?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because of his excellent academic record, I'm going to give him a life sentence this time. But if I ever see your son in the courtroom again, I'm going to lock him up and throw away the key. I'm going to lock you up with him.
What to give you, blood?
3 months, man.
What you doing in here anyway? You ought to be home with your mama. How old are you, boy?
13.
Damn. The bastards must be running out of niggas to arrest.
He was just 14 years old when he confessed to and was convicted of a quadruple murder in Detroit. But today, 23-year-old Devontae Sanford walks out of Ionia State Prison a free man. His conviction was vacated Tuesday by Wayne County Circuit Judge Brian Sullivan. The judge agreed with arguments that Sanford's case had all the hallmarks of a false confession. David Moran is a University of Michigan clinical professor of law, and he directs the Michigan Innocence Clinic. He was co-counsel in this case. David, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
What were the inconsistencies in Devontae's case?
First of all, you got to understand how Devontae came into this. The police responded to the scene of a quadruple murder on Detroit's east side, and they found several neighbors milling around, and among them was Devontae Sanford, a 14-year-old, 5'5" kid, wearing his pajamas. And for reasons that we can't fathom, the detective in charge of the case decided that this kid somehow knew something, took him downtown, interrogated him without a parent or guardian present for hours, brought him back home, and then the next day took him back down to Detroit Police Headquarters again without a parent and guardian present, and again interrogated him for hours. So the story that eventually emerges, the so-called false confession, was full of facts that were simply wrong. So Devontae claimed that he and three other kids had committed this robbery and murdered all the occupants of the house. But the other three kids were all cleared within 72 hours. They all had rock-solid alibis. He said they each had a different kind of weapon. He named the four weapons they supposedly had. That didn't match the ballistics. In fact, there were only two perpetrators seen fleeing the house, and there were two types of bullets that were found at the scene that did not match up with the bullets that Devontae claimed. He said where they dumped the weapons afterwards, the police searched there, and no weapons were found there. He said they met up at a Coney Island restaurant to plan the robbery beforehand, but that Coney Island restaurant had been closed for months. So virtually everything in the confession was false. In fact, what we did later was we had Jim Tranum, who is a nationally known police expert. He was a former detective in D.C. who was actually famous because he extracted a false confession in the 1990s from a woman. And then years later, she was exonerated, and he went back and looked at it. And so since then, he's become an expert in what makes a confession false, how the police should do interrogations. Mm-hmm. And so co-counsel here was the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth at Northwestern Law School, led by Megan Crane. They contacted Jim Tranum in D.C., and he analyzed Devontae's confession. And what he concluded was that every single fact that Devontae got right in the confession was something the police already knew. Every single fact that the police didn't already know, he got wrong. And that's the hallmark of a false confession. The only things you're getting right are what the police already know. In other words, the police are feeding you the facts. He also analyzed Vincent Smothers' confession, which came sometime later.
In fact, let's go to this. Vincent Smothers, who is a professional hitman, admitted to the killings.
That's
and he
right.
did it 8 years ago. Why did it take so long for this day to come for Devontae Sanford to go free?
And that's a great question for the Detroit police and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. So just 16 days after Devontae Sanford was sentenced to 39 to 82 years, Vincent Smothers was picked up on a contract killing. And he tells the police that the gig is up and he will confess to all of the contract killings he committed over the previous few years. They turn the cameras on, and Smothers confesses in great and extremely accurate detail to 12, including the four on Runyon Street. And what they ended up doing was charging him only with the other eight. And then they gave him a deal to second-degree murder, even though they had him cold for first-degree murder. It gave him a deal to second-degree murder, which had the effect of preventing him from going to trial, because had he gone to trial, it almost certainly would have come out that he had confessed to Runyon Street as well.
And totally blown up what they had done.
That's right.
With Dante.
And his confession was extraordinarily accurate in every detail. Two perpetrators who fit the description of the perpetrators who were seen fleeing. He named his accomplice in the killing. He told the police where they would find one of the guns used in the killing, and they did, at a home associated with the accomplice. He said that the other gun would match some of the other, ballistically would match some of the other killings that he had committed, that he was confessing to, which it did. Everything fit together. And yet the defense didn't find out about this for almost a year. The police and the prosecution kept it under wraps for nearly a year until the state appellate defender office, which was representing Devante at the time, finally found out about it.
As this has played itself out for all of these years, where is this resistance from the prosecutors coming from?
You know, I don't know. Kim Worthy will be holding a press conference tomorrow, and I think that's a question for her. It's certainly not just a Detroit phenomenon. We find, and other Innocence Projects, Innocence Clinics around the country, in fact, even internationally, find that there is often great resistance to admitting that a mistake has been made. And even, frankly, wacky theories are advanced in order to try and explain away when the new evidence doesn't match the preconceived conviction. And so in this case, I know there was talk of that, well, maybe Vincent Smothers and his accomplice used Devante as an assistant, which was an idea that was just ridiculous to Vincent Smothers. I've met Vincent Smothers. We got a 26-page affidavit from him about the killings. And the idea that he and his adult accomplice would use a 5'5", 14-year-old kid to carry out a professional hit is just ridiculous. But it's the sort of cognitive dissonance that we see sometimes, is that the police and the prosecution just can't accept that they got it wrong. It's a human thing. And it's very difficult to accept that you got it wrong. And so they start spinning weird and wild theories as to how, well, maybe we still got it right after all. And I'm very thankful to Kim Worthy that faced with the Michigan State Police's reinvestigation, and that's what ultimately brought this case to a head, is we filed, the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth and the Michigan Innocence Clinic last April filed the motion for relief from judgment in Wayne Circuit Court. And as a result of that and the publicity surrounding that filing, the Michigan State Police got interested. Kim Worthy authorized a reinvestigation by the state police. That reinvestigation took over a year. But when it came out on May 20th, it was apparently, we haven't seen it yet, it was apparently devastating to the prosecution's case. And so Kim Worthy did the right thing and pulled the plug on it yesterday.
You do a lot of this kind of work around the country. David, put this case in context for us. How does Devante Sanford's case compare with other wrongful conviction cases you've worked on in the past?
Well, there are a lot of commonalities between this case and other cases around the country. There are now nearly 2,000 exonerations that are recorded on the National Registry of Exonerations at the University of Michigan Law School and Northwestern Law School. And many of the same causes of wrongful convictions that happen in the Devante Sanford case happen in hundreds of these other cases. So false confessions is a leading cause in about 25% of all the exonerations so far. The defendant falsely confessed. Police misconduct is a common feature of wrongful convictions. And in this case, apparently a police commander claimed that Devante, during one of the interrogation sessions, had drawn a very accurate map of the living room where the four people were killed. And in fact, eventually he admitted that Devante didn't draw that map and the police drew that map. So that's an example of police misconduct. The fact that they didn't turn over what Vincent Smothers was saying for nearly a year is an example of police misconduct. Terrible lawyering is a feature, especially in Michigan, but across the country, that leads to wrongful convictions. And Devante had a terrible lawyer in this case, a man who has been disciplined over and over again. His license is currently suspended for a B&E, but he's been disciplined or reprimanded, I believe, more than 20 times at this point.
And how is a 14-year-old kid going to know what kind of public defender has been appointed for him?
Right. Well, actually, his lawyer was retained.
He was retained. Okay.
He was retained by the family, but he never challenged the confession. I mean, the most obvious point to any competent attorney is that when a 14-year-old kid is taken in the middle of the night without his parents or his family or any guardian present and interrogated twice on two consecutive nights, 4 hours, emerging with a confession that is obviously false, does not match the facts, that is confession, it should be suppressed. And there are constitutional grounds to suppress a confession like that. And he didn't even move to suppress it. The only other evidence against Devante at trial that had any significance was the surviving victim managed to crawl under a bed. So she couldn't see the perpetrators. But she heard the voice of one of the perpetrators. And she testified at trial that the voice of one of the perpetrators sounded like it could be Devante's voice. But Michigan law actually makes that sort of testimony inadmissible unless the victim or the witness has a prior familiarity with the voice. But again, the defense lawyer didn't move to suppress this unreliable, basically junk testimony that should never have come in the first place. So after hearing that testimony and hearing the confession of the officer, the confession of Dante through the testimony of the officer, the attorney told the family that it was hopeless and he should plead guilty. And so that's what Devante did. He pleaded guilty to four counts of second-degree murder midway through the trial instead of even finishing the trial because the case was hopeless, which, in fact, it was, given the extremely substandard representation of the lawyer.
It certainly is a story that is startling to the public, which would like to think that the wheels of justice move in the right direction and do the right thing.
They do occasionally. In this case, the wheels of justice finally moved in the right direction, but Devante Sanford lost 9 years of his life from age 14 to 23. And if we all think about how important those years are in our development, Devante Sanford spent much of that time in solitary confinement in Michigan State prisons because he was a kid. And this is a complete and utter failure of the criminal justice system. And the fact that we got it right now makes me feel very good, but it doesn't undo the damage that was been done to Devante Sanford.
David Moran, University of Michigan, clinical professor of law with the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Thank you so much for being with us, David.
My pleasure.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Damn you, Obama.
Good evening. I'm Maureen McFadden. Concord Community Schools are facing allegations of racial discrimination after a black student was called a racial slur over a year ago. News Center 16's Sean Gallagher joins me now. And Sean, what's the school being accused of here?
Well, really just not acting accordingly when handling this case. Now, last year, then 11-year-old Nyzeria Neely was a student at Concord Middle School when she received three notes over 3 weeks threatening her and using the N-word. And now the Indiana Civil Rights Commission says the school is liable for racial discrimination because of how they handled this situation.
I felt like people didn't want me at the school because of my color or my race.
It's been over a year since Nyzeria Neely attended Concord Middle School when she went through 3 weeks where she received notes like this in her locker using the N-word and threatening her.
I was sad and I felt betrayed by a lot of people.
The incident forced Nyzeria to transfer to Pierre Moran Middle School.
When it first happened, I wanted to like break down and like just start crying and just let out all my emotions and stuff like that.
When her father found out, he tried to get the school involved but felt they didn't do enough.
I was frustrated. They just tried to sweep it up under the rug and like it wasn't a big thing about it, which it was.
And Concord Schools was not available for an interview but released the following statement. Concord Schools does not and will not tolerate racism in any form. The family's allegation of racial discrimination was the only such allegation made against Concord Community Schools in a decade. When all facts are known, any court or independent tribunal will determine that Concord Community Schools acted appropriately.
It makes me feel a little at ease, you know, because something is finally getting done and they are finally getting caught, I put it that way.
And Elkhart community leader Jason Moreno, who helped Nigeria's family find the Indiana Civil Rights Commission, released this statement just minutes ago. Concord's pompous posturing and obfuscation of the facts has been a constant factor in this and other civil rights matters levied against the school in the past 2 years. And we are confident the truth will prevail and Concord will continue its trajectory of having to adapt through the force of the courts into a more inclusive world.
Okay, so how does the school say they handled the situation?
Well, they say when they found out about the incident that they immediately started their own investigation, interviewing students, teachers, and parents, as well as collecting handwriting samples and also informing local police about what had happened.
Okay, we'll be following this.
That's for sure.
Thanks a lot, Sean.
Every nigger is a star. Every nigger is a star. Cooler than I. Yes, every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Yes, every nigga is a star.
Are Seattleites complacent in the face of hatred? Last month, two colleagues were chatting at a Starbucks on Capitol Hill when something outrageous happened. It was loud, it was hostile. It was racist and sexist, and virtually no one in that Starbucks stepped in to help. Those two colleagues are Yoshiko Hardin and Bob Hughes, both college administrators. She's at Seattle Central. He's at Seattle University, both African-American. They told me what happened, and I want to warn you before you listen that you might find the language here very disturbing.
It was Friday morning. We had a 10 o'clock meeting at Starbucks just to catch up. Bob and I have known each other through the education system for a while, and I'm new to my role at Seattle Central. So he reached out to say, would you like to meet? I hear you're back kind of on the Hill and at the college, which is great. So we met. It was about 10:30. We were about a half hour into our meeting, and I felt something warm on my face and my forearms, and I thought that someone had tripped and spilled their drink, their warm drink. And so I looked over and there was a young white male looking at me. And can you swear on radio?
We can try.
Okay. So, and I looked at him and he said, you know, "F-ing nigger bitch." And I kind of stopped. And it was at that point I realized it was spit on my face and hands, that he had spit on me. And then he kind of wound up to do it again and spit again and got on me again. And for sure, at that point, I saw that it got on Bob and got on his coat. And then he yelled again and just kind of casually walked out. I got up to get some napkins and he stood at the window and was yelling. We couldn't hear him, but assume he was yelling around the same language, same thing.
What did you guess at what was going on in his head? What do you think it was about?
Well, in that moment, I thought he's gonna kill me. Is what I thought. And, you know, my professional background, 15 years working in race, ethnicity, justice work, and studied all of these type of scenarios and have been called all of those names before, but never just someone popped off. You know, usually like I cut them off on the freeway or took their parking spot. So that was what was stunning to me. Many people have said, well, he must be crazy, quote unquote, or he must.
That's the first thing that came to mind. If he's yelling for appropriate of absolutely nothing.
Yeah. So I've seen people, I know people in my family, I see people around my job who I think might be mentally ill because they're displaying behaviors, like talking to themselves. And he wasn't displaying any of those behaviors. So my first thought was, do I know him? And then I thought he's going to kill me.
If you'll remember, it's actually my first question to you. Do you know this guy?
Yes.
After he had walked out, because he's a much smaller man than I am. I wasn't particularly afraid, but I was kind of trying to figure out where does he come from. And I agree with Yoshiko. I walk up and down James and Pioneer Square every day to get to work. And I've got a pretty good sense of when somebody is mentally unbalanced or displaying those kinds of behaviors. That's not what this was. This was anger. This was hate. This was someone who saw her and decided he was going to unleash his anger and hatred.
How did the people around you react to
to what had happened?
Well, there was a woman, a white woman, who was down near the till where you order food. And she was the person who said, "Manager, manager, your customers are being called racial epithets," I think is the language she used. "And they're being spit on." And that's how the manager was notified that something was happening in the store table area.
But what struck you both, it sounds like, was how little reaction there was outside of this one woman, this one white woman.
Absolutely. After the incident, we waited at least an hour, maybe an hour and a half for the police. We didn't go anywhere. We were in the same spot. Nobody approached us. Nobody looked at us. Nobody talked to us. It was as if the incident didn't happen.
And this was a mixed race crowd or all white,
yeah,
or who was there?
It was a mixed race crowd. So it was very diverse. There were other black people in the Starbucks and there were other black women. There were white people. I mean, it was a regular busy morning, people on their devices, people coming in and out.
And what did it say to you that there was so little reaction?
That it wasn't important. That, you know, something that had really changed my life didn't show up as meaningful or impactful for others besides Bob and the woman who came over. And I think one of the things I said to Bob after it happened is, this is so bizarre. Like, this just happened to us, but yet everyone's life just goes on as if nothing has happened. You know, you can still hear the machines whirring, you know, making milk steaming, like nothing stopped.
And that is bizarre to me. If we had been in a car wreck, would people have just walked by? Would people have stopped and tried to do something? It's been really interesting over the last month or so since the incident, and I posted my blog. I got a significant number of responses of people saying, well, no wonder they didn't respond. No one responded. You didn't respond. Well, I don't expect that anyone would physically intervene in an instant when neither one of us were physically responding. We were shocked by it. But I do expect that people would involve themselves afterward, as this woman did. I mean, the woman who notified the manager made a point of coming up to me and to Yoshiko and saying, look, this should never happen to people, and if you want a witness, I'm here. That seems to be sad to me that only one person did that.
Is what you were hoping for basically what that one woman did?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was hoping for. I mean, some of it's in retrospect, but even the police, when they came, the police officer said, I'm surprised that no citizens intervened. Sometimes people will intervene to hold someone until we get here. So they even noted, like, no one said stopped or even said anything to the person, like, get out of here, or, you know, challenged the young man who did this.
I want to ask you, I wasn't there.
Yeah.
But I wonder if maybe I'm one of these people, white male in my case, although there were others there, I might have been one of those people who wouldn't have responded. I'm trying to put myself in that space. For one thing, somebody yelled, I'm looking away, I probably didn't see spit. When I hear someone yell, even something like what he yelled at you, I think I probably would have thought there's a fight going on, even though there wasn't, right? It was probably a fight that didn't involve me. I'm not sure what's wanted of me in this situation. I might have kept on looking at my device. And I wonder, since the rest of the crowd isn't here, you can put it on me. Like, what does it say about me? What are you thinking that that says to you?
It says to me that your own personal whatever activity is more important than the community in which you're engaged. That seems to me a mistake. I think you need to look. If you hear something like that, you need to say, what's going on here? Is this something that does concern me? Because, frankly, it was. This is a public space in which somebody assaulted two people. And if you allow that to happen as a member of a community, then what do you want from your community? What happens when it happens to you? Do you want somebody to be there to at least pay attention to the fact that you're being assaulted? It seems to me that the action is to ignore, and that's not something that you should do or I should do. You know, if it had been a child being beaten by an adult, would you have paid attention? If it had been somebody taking out some sort of weapon and hurting somebody, would you pay attention? At what level do you start paying attention? And my point is, if we're going to live as part of a community, we need to be aware of those things that happen. And let's say that this was a young man who knew us both and decided he was angry with us and decided to assault us. Well, regardless of that, you have a responsibility to know that that happened. You have a responsibility to not necessarily intervene. Again, I make the point that I don't expect people to intervene. I do expect people to pay attention.
My first reaction was that, yeah, I don't, a ruckus, something broke out. I don't think I would have said anything. It's not my business. But as you're explaining it so vividly now, I guess, yeah, I hope I would have at least said, are you okay?
I think that's all it takes for a community to act as a community. Something that simple.
Well, what gets us thinking about this is when you draw a connection between being quiet at a Starbucks, you know, in a case like this, a connection between that and a bigger, a silence, a denial, an apathy, you start to hit people where they live, because I don't think most of our listeners, at least most of our white listeners, I'm not sure would make a connection between looking at their device, looking away, and a bigger apathy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can support causes, right? And then it's another thing when it is there in your face. It's a different test. You know,
you know, here's something else. Confessions of a white person here. It's awkward to come and say that man just yelled horrible things at you. You know, I don't stand with that. I'm one of the good white people. It, you know, there's something that feels a little self-congratulating and patronizing about that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think that's something
like
white people
you can handle yourself.
I think that's something that, you know, like my white colleagues and friends who support our anti-racism work, that's something that they deal with, is wanting to be supportive but not patronizing, and wanting to participate but not come in as if they're going to run it and own it. That's not how I would have experienced that, but I think that's something that that's a fair statement, right? That I now approach this, you know, black couple as a white person who just experienced an assault by another white person. And what is that going to mean to them?
Right. So what's the right way to insert in a way that's respectful of you, of everything that's gone on?
What you said earlier, I think, is really a strong statement. Are you okay? Come and ask me if I'm okay. Don't ignore me. Don't look away. Don't pretend that nothing happened when something really did. We have a, you know, the Seattle nice culture that we talk a lot about and we laugh about it. But underlying that are some really deep truths about who we are as a community in terms of being engaged with people who are different than us. We're more segregated today than we have been as segregated today as we have been in this city's history. I mean, look at our schools, look at our communities, who lives where. You know, all of that has significant impacts on how we interact with each other. And if we don't ask questions, if we don't engage, and especially when we see something deeply going wrong, if we don't engage in that, then we're at danger as a community of further segmenting, of further isolating ourselves from each other, and we'll never come to being aware of each other and our needs.
That's so interesting to think of even something as outrageous as that to have been an opportunity to just ask you a question. How are you doing? That stands in for so much, so many opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell people, just say, I don't know what to say, but I feel really uncomfortable. I mean, I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to have it all perfect and processed and just, you know what? I don't know what to say in this moment, but I feel really uncomfortable about what I witnessed. And are you all okay? It doesn't need to be perfect.
Yoshiko Harden and Bob Hughes, both college administrators here in Seattle. Bob is an associate dean, Seattle University. Yoshiko, vice president of student services at Seattle Central. Yoshiko told me that what happened to her was traumatic, that she has been depressed, anxious, unable to focus, to sleep, And she wants you to know this is not an isolated incident, that this is part of the fabric of how racism and sexism play out. And I'd like to know, is that your experience? How have you personally seen race and gender and difference dealt with here in Western Washington? And what is your part in it? Write to us at record@kuow.org.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
I'm very, very pleased to be able to bring you the following conversation. There was a documentary by Vice Canada that got released a couple of weeks ago. The documentary is called This is Dixon, and that documentary attempts to tell a story about a community of high-rise condominiums in Northwest Toronto called Dixon. Many of you know Dixon. I'm sure a lot of our listeners live in Dixon who are listening to the show right now or know people who do. And there was a premise, I guess, about this documentary that there is gang activity in Dixon, and that the folks who wanted to make the documentary were kind of making it to find out whether or not a gang truly did exist in that community. The way that this half-hour documentary played out has made a lot of people who actually live in Dixon, particularly people in the Somali community, very, very upset and raise a lot of questions. Four of them are in studio to speak with us right now. Before we get to the conversation, though, I want to give you a little bit of context. So here is a clip from the beginning of This is Dixon, where our narrator in the story is explaining to us kind of why he decided to tell this story.
Asians, Jamaicans, and white Canadians. The kids from the different buildings would hang out, we played some tennis, and looking back, I have some pretty fond memories of my time spent there. So when I saw media reports with police saying that this is the breeding ground for a violent gang, a gang apparently called the Dixon City Bloods, I was surprised to say the least. It's a far cry from the community of families I'd known as a kid.
So there's the narrator of the piece talking about how he grew up going and spending his summers in Dixon, and he thought it was a kind of peaceful, family-oriented place, and that he was surprised later on to hear that there was a lot of gang activity. And that's kind of where the film proceeds from and begins this investigation into what is going on in the community. But what the result of that documentary shows and the conclusions that it tries to draw or not draw made a lot of people upset. Four of them are in studio with me right now. They're from a collective called the Not Dixon Collective. Did I get that right? That's Not Dixon is the name of the collective. And joining me in studio right now are Ubdi. Hello.
Hi.
Lali.
Hey.
Hey, Lali. We also have Adil.
Hi.
Hello, Adil. And Hawa.
Hey.
How are you guys all doing?
We're doing well.
Thanks for joining us at News Talk 1010 to speak about this. Let me just first try to understand, for our listeners' sake, what is it about this half-hour documentary in Dixon which features an investigation into alleged gang activity in the community that has gotten all of you guys so fired up and upset? Who wants to go?
Well, you know, that introduction that you just played over the radio is great, in fact. But then for the next 29 minutes, the documentary goes into some tired, boring, and long-held stereotypes of Somalis, that they are violent, that they are dangerous. And what this does is it makes life unbearable for those who are living and loving and creating lives in Dixon. The Vice documentary is irresponsible in its representation, the ways in which it perpetuates particular narratives of Somalis. And these narratives aren't new, right? For the past 30 years, media institutions have been saying the same thing about Somalis. And often they vilify them as Muslims, they vilify them as newcomers, and they vilify them as black. And so we are upset by the ways in which this documentary forwards anti-black racism, Islamophobia, and anti-Somali sentiment.
Now, Lali, you say it vilifies members of your community. Now, for everyone's awareness who's listening, we did invite Alia Davidson, one of the directors of this film, to come on the program as well and to talk about it from her perspective of things, why she made this film, what she thinks about the controversy. And we didn't receive a response, unfortunately. But you're saying vilifies. I think one of the contentions from the filmmakers was that they included the voices of Somali people in the film. So how could they vilify people by letting them talk in a film?
So I just want to clarify one thing really quickly, is that none of us are actually from Dixon. And that's that it's really important, because what this does is perpetuate a stereotype about Somalis nationwide and, in fact, internationally. It's not Dixon is the example being used in this documentary, but it actually, there's a longstanding history of Canadian institutions, the media, the police, the justice system, healthcare, CAS, who have used this particular narrative of Somalis being violent, of Somalis being Muslim and Black, of Somalis being quote-unquote savage, to explain away the harms that are done to the Somali community. So I think that's important to talk about, because it's not just, I'm not surprised Alia didn't come, in fact, because her response has been relative silence to most of these critiques and concerns, and she hasn't had much to say to many of us.
Now, the documentary kind of proceeds by talking about the community of Dixon, and we know that a lot of attention came to Dixon during the time of Mayor Rob Ford, the late mayor of Toronto, because of an investigation into his alleged criminal activity. But Mayor Rob Ford is actually kind of a passing reference in this documentary. And I know that that's something that has angered a lot of people in the community, too. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was sort of one of the major critiques that we had about this particular film, is that we understand that Mayor Ford and the Ford family was quite central to this, right? And sort of providing him a pass and providing that particular interaction, which is this tape, and pardon me, subsequently the things that happened as a result of this tape, were essentially given this sort of really quick mention, right? And in that case, our question is, well, why not focus on sort of what might have been the preemptive factors of what this story was, right? So there's a choice. The choice is, should we take up what is this white, powerful man's narrative and sort of excavate that and really look at, like, what happened here? But instead, what we do, or what Vice has chosen to do effectively, is take a very white supremacist approach to this, which is go into this community of Black folks, center them as problematic, center their interactions and what's happening in that community as problematic, and yet not really look at what happened in the house on Windsor Avenue? What happened specifically with the case with Mayor Rob Ford? What are all of the other social political factors that give rise to what's happening here? So essentially what it is, it's a very small snippet of what is a broader and larger experience. And at the end of the documentary, spoiler alert, right? So actually, I do want to be the spoiler alert. People don't watch it. The documentary effectively ends by saying, we don't know, in fact, if these gangs do exist or not.
Yeah, that was the question that they tried to answer. They came into it saying, we want to find out if there is a gang, and ended by saying, well, we've done all this work and we don't know.
Yeah, which is again, it's you know, some people are saying, well, they didn't say that there is a gang or there isn't a gang, but something else happened here. And what happened here was it created question. And sometimes, and especially in the Black community, creating question is enough. And we see what's happened in the city when Blackness has been questioned, right? We see the outcome of what that is. And you create a moral panic by insinuating, by being subversive about whether or not these things actually exist or not. Because who... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No.
I was going to say, well, who would create the assumption from a lay person not knowing this community would say, well, why would someone create a documentary if, in fact, nothing really exists?
Right.
And this ending, the way it ended with this indecisive, does it exist, does it not exist, is really important, not just because it creates a moral panic, but it allows people to come to their own conclusions. And by doing that, it basically people can fabricate their own stories. And we have seen throughout history how this can lead to policies, documents, and laws created based on this mythical, based on any sort of myth, right? And so we see that with anti-terrorism legislation. We see this with so much more of this fear of this stranger constantly coming up. And we see this documentary ending off in that sort of a way is actually worse than ending off with something more decisive, because people now have the power to
people can now fabricate whatever they would like, and the problematics of that is what that could lead to. If I was
the president. We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and eight others knew all of this history. But he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin. Oh, but God works in mysterious ways.
Last June, a year ago, a gunman attacked the historic Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. The pastors and eight other worshipers were killed during Bible study as they bowed their heads in prayer. The church is affectionately known as Mother Emmanuel, and it's been a spark for social change since the days of slavery. Today, as NPR's Debbie Elliott reports, the church is an even larger symbol of the nation's ongoing struggle for racial justice.
Just days after the tragic shooting on Wednesday night, June 17th, the pews at Emmanuel AME were filled for Sunday worship.
Let somebody say hallelujah.
A black cloth draped the chair where Emmanuel's pastor, State Senator Clemente Pinckney, should have been sitting. Having the sanctuary open for service when the basement below was a fresh crime scene served as a powerful witness for a nation shocked by official accounts that a young white man had targeted the church out of racial hatred. Here's Joe Riley, who was Charleston's mayor at the time.
The only reason someone could walk into church and shoot people praying is out of hate. The only reason.
Authorities say suspect Dylan Roof chose the church for the racially motivated assault in order to magnify the societal impact. Emmanuel AME is one of the oldest black congregations in the South and was already culturally significant. It has survived arson, natural disasters, and an antebellum ban on black churches. One of its founders organized a slave revolt. Civil rights marchers gathered here, and Booker T. Washington and Martin Luther King Jr. spoke from the pulpit. Mother Emmanuel's tall brown spire is a Charleston landmark. Today, the wrought iron gate surrounding the church is locked, and a security guard stands watch.
Yeah, Emmanuel has become part tourist attraction, part shrine.
The Reverend Joseph Darby is vice president of the Charleston NAACP. He's also a presiding elder with the AME Church in South Carolina. Standing on the sidewalk in front of Emmanuel, Darby says since the mass shooting, people have come from all over to see the church.
And you get tour buses.
A bus parks across the street and people snap pictures through the windows. Darby says all the attention has been a mixed blessing. For some, he says, coming here serves as an act of atonement.
There's a need, particularly for some good white folks, to say, I am not Dylan Roof. This does not represent me.
And it's not just tourists. There's a steady stream of journalists like me. The governor and U.S. senators have come to worship. So has the vice president. President Obama delivered the eulogy at the Reverend Clemente Pinckney's funeral.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
Damn you, Obama. Earlier this year, Charleston was the site of a congressional pilgrimage centered on the Emmanuel massacre, and other groups have been taking a close look at what happened here.
Whatever.
At Charleston's Second Presbyterian Church, just a block behind Emmanuel, pastors from around the country came for a session about the meaning of the church in a post-Mother Emmanuel world.
We're going to talk with one another about what happened June 17th.
Pastor Spike Coleman from St. Andrew's Presbyterian led the session. He works as a volunteer chaplain and responded to the Emmanuel shooting.
For many of us, that will be very difficult. And in a real sense, you're standing on holy ground right now.
Among those sharing their experiences was Police Major Naomi Broughton, who coordinated the response in the chaotic aftermath.
I've never seen the multitude of victims as forgiving as this. There was a lot of angry people. I was angry. I don't know if I would have been as gracious as those family members were.
One of the most dramatic examples of that came at the initial hearing for suspect Dylan Roof, which was televised. The judge allowed the victims' families to speak. Nadine Collier's mother, Ethel Lance, was killed.
I would never talk to her ever again. I would never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you and have mercy on your soul.
A year later, the conversation has turned to justice. 22-year-old Dylan Roof will go on trial later this year. He faces the death penalty on both state and federal charges. Some of the families of those slain are against a death sentence. Others support it.
He took 9 lives. He made the decision. He sat with them for an hour.
Melvin Graham is the brother of Cynthia Hurd, the Charleston librarian killed in the Emmanuel attack. He says mercy and forgiveness don't negate the need for punishment.
This was a purposeful act. This was a murderous act. This was a hateful act. And therefore, he should pay the consequences for his action.
For the families, the ongoing court hearings and now the anniversary events are tough.
The hard part is it doesn't go away. It doesn't go away. So you have to deal with this day in and day out.
So does the Mother Emmanuel congregation. And it's been difficult. In the months following the shooting, millions of dollars in donations poured in. There were allegations that church leaders mishandled the funds. Lawsuits ensued, but have since been settled. And the church recently distributed $1.5 million to the victims' families. Now, a new leader has taken the pulpit, Emmanuel's first woman pastor.
Hello. I'm the Reverend Dr. Betty Days Clark, pastor of Mother Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church.
Here she is with a YouTube message inviting worshipers for Easter sunrise service.
Last summer, our church suffered a great tragedy, but we never gave up our faith. We never gave up on God because God never gives up on us. Through it all, our church stands strong.
Standing strong as it has for nearly 200 years. The congregation is planning a series of commemorative events in the coming weeks to honor victims and survivors of the Mother Emmanuel Massacre. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Charleston.
I can introduce him simply by saying he is one of the most honest individuals I have ever met in my life. Ladies and gentlemen, the heavyweight champion of the world, to me, Muhammad Ali.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another version of Bill Roden on Sports. We're recording, we're taping live in Harlem, USA at Chocolat. Anyway, we're here with our co-host, great Jamal Murphy. Jamal.
Great to be here again with multiple legends this time.
Usually
I'm just talking to one legend.
Legends. Yeah, the Baron of Frederick Douglass and the owner of Chocolat, Leon Ellis, is here. Leon?
That's my pleasure to be here.
Yep. And our guest here for a second time on Bill Roden on Sports is Walter Beach III. Walter Beach III from Pontiac.
Pontiac
Mission. Walter, welcome to the show.
No, thank you, Bill.
Obviously, Ali passed away on Friday, and for the last 5 days, the airways have been filled with tributes and recollections and all that, including for people who hated him back then but now say they love him. But I just like to, I know, Leon, you got to go. You got to take care of the restaurant, but just briefly, and Walter, again, you're from, I'd just like to get everybody's quick take on, not so much what you thought of as passing, but sort of what he meant to you, what is life meant to you, and sort of going forward, what do you think his life should mean? Why don't we start with you, Walter, since you are our special guest, and make sure you put the...
Well, all right. Basically, Ali, in terms of the several times that I was in his presence, and he was a dynamic and powerful human being, and as a I come out of a situation where my dad and my three uncles were race men, so they talked about the standard of a black man. So that's how I was so nurtured. And Ali represented that. Ali, and I just got off of another radio program in Chicago about an hour ago. And one of the things that I wanted to say, and I wanted to make certain that I said it here, is that everybody that is reflecting on Ali today have only done so in some abstract concept, context. No one knew what that particular experience was in the 60s. It was nothing you just took lightly.
Right, right.
And unfortunately, that's what kind of saddens me about this whole situation of Ali, is there everybody want to deal with it, you know. But there were a few individuals, and I can name some of them. When Ali didn't have a job for 3.5 years, he had to eat. He had to take care of his family. And there are some black men that helped him to do that.
Right.
And now those individuals who help him do that are kind of relegated to the second aspect of his life. And I think that someone just come in here and said, Clinton's going to do the,
right.
What do you call
the,
that?
The eulogy.
The eulogy.
Which
you know?
Is a whole other thing.
Yeah. But,
how's
yeah, yeah, but where was he
right.
when Ali was, they took his crown, they took his job. So,
right.
That, but that's always been part of my understanding of what he meant to me. He was just a great human being. I didn't know that much about his soul and how all of that developed. But if you were in his presence, you were touched, and I'm talking about in his physical presence,
right.
Not what you see on the television.
Right.
But now they want to make him great, and I want to say this because they put Malcolm X on a stamp,
right.
But that wasn't his struggle.
Right.
Undoubtedly, Ali may go on a stamp.
I'm sure.
They want to put Sojourner Truth on a $20 bill. But these are black people, man, who suffered in slavery, Jim Crow, and all of that. And no one is talking about that. They want to talk about that's all I want to say
right now.
You
go on forever, I'm sure. Let me say, we got time. We're rolling on sports, man. But no, I want to also put Walter in context. We can't show it because obviously it's a podcast. But in 1967, there's a very famous photo of some of the top athletes of all time who flew into Cleveland, basically at Jim Brown's behest. Now, what I forgot to mention in the introduction, that Walter Beach III was a quarterback for the Cleveland Browns and was a member of the Cleveland championship team, the only and the last championship team, professional team, that has won a championship in Cleveland. He was a member of the 64 Cleveland Browns. In fact, that was the same year that Ali beat Liston. That Ali became the heavyweight champion. So we've got this iconic picture, and here is Walter Beach, a young and dapper. Now, Walter still looks dapper. And he's young at heart, no question about it. But here he is in the back with his turtleneck and all that. But who do we have in this picture? We've got
That's Carl Stokes.
Carl Stokes.
At that particular time, I was the youth coordinator for the city of Cleveland, and Carl Stokes was the mayor, the first black mayor in a major city. So I was his staff.
And then standing next to you on your...
It's Bobby Mitchell.
The great Bobby Mitchell.
Great Bobby Mitchell, right.
Right, who you had a lot of. I'm sure that was probably one of the friendliest confrontations you had.
Yeah, he scared you to death out there on the corner, man.
Bobby, yeah. And then next to Bobby, who's that?
Sidney Williams. He was a linebacker for the Cleveland Browns.
And over here?
That's McClinton. He played with the Kansas City Chiefs, right.
And over here?
Willie Davis, he was the Green Bay Packers. Right, John Wooten is not on this.
Oh, he's cut off. John Wooten.
He played with Cleveland. Then there's the great Bill Russell, Muhammad Ali,
and then Jim Brown.
Jim Brown, and to Jim's left on that pitch was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
We could go back to this, but I'm always curious because I've seen this picture so much. I've got framed and all. This was such a powerful image of all these powerful black athletes. The biggest one at the time coming back to support. Ali, were you in the meeting the night before when they met with him?
Yeah, we met. Yeah, I was in all of the meetings. And, I don't like to really talk about the athletes of today in terms of what the commitment was. But none of these individuals, they came from all over the country. None of them got paid. None of them, airfare was absorbed.
Right.
None of the hotel that they stayed in, they did this on their own. And I would probably suggest if you could get a professional athlete today to fly in to support someone like Ali, you'd have to give him some money.
At least.
Put him up in a hotel and pay for his airfare.
Right.
It's just a different time. We just different men at different times. That's all I can say.
I'm curious. Obviously, I wasn't in the room at the time. I was 14 years old. But what was it like? What was the tone of the conversation? Because, you got as athletes, professional athletes, I think there were some guys there who probably were a little skeptical.
Of course,
there were some who believed him. I mean, what was the question? Like, was it a grilling?
I served 4 years in the United States Air Force as a cryptographic operator before I played professional football in college. So going to the military, I thought that was my responsibility and obligation. Bobby Mitchell was an officer in the United States Army. Jim Brown was a captain in the United States Army. So it was more than just a discussion about being a conscientious objector and not addressing the shortcomings of this country. And Ali made it very clear. He said, no Vietnam has ever called me a nigger.
Right.
Well, I couldn't say that like he could say it. But when I was in the United States Air Force, that's all I was most of the time. And I know people have them funny discussions today about the N-word. I don't support that. Because when you ask me, don't use the N-word, I mean now, never, next. That's the N-word to me. Nigger to me means nigger. So I'm not afraid of it, and I don't squirm from it. And I don't know if this was probably on one of those programs that probably beep it out. But I mean, I know what that means, and I know what that is, and I lived that for 83 years. 83 years I've lived what that is. I breathe that air. And Muhammad Ali made us all aware of it, that we breathe that air. There are no sanctuaries. And Joe Louis, who was another top boxer, Joe Louis coined another phrase that a lot of young people will know. He said, you can run, but you can't hide.
That's right.
So black folks can run, but they can't hide. And sir, let me just say one thing. My son went to Tuskegee.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, Arif, my son, he graduated from Tuskegee. But I want to share this quick experience because you said something, and I think it's so important, when you mentioned your son. And you mentioned your son, and I have another son who went to the University of Michigan. So we were having a discussion at the house. My son who went to the University of Michigan, we were talking about religion, and we were talking about race. My son's very bright and very intelligent. And he looked at me and he said, Daddy, he said, I don't talk about race and religion. And it offended me because I'm saying, man, race and what Ali did is the only reason you got in the University of Michigan. But
exactly.
Now you don't want to talk about it. See, that's how deep it gets. we get locked in to some stuff that ain't really got nothing to do with us. It's got something to do with the people on the other side.
Right.
But, I mean, you went to the University of Michigan. Do you know that black men couldn't get into University of Michigan? To Dr. King and Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X start doing the stuff that they do? Now, you don't want to talk about it.
Right.
And that goes back to what you were saying before about people who pretend to have to have praised him all along and now coming along saying he was a great man. But at the same time, because of these other people's actions, our own kids don't feel comfortable talking about race and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and it's so interesting, I mean, when you talk about Clinton even, and when you mentioned it, I want to really start going back to the archives because I want to see where Clinton was in 1967, you know, down in Arkansas somewhere. I mean, you know, how in life, I mean, I'm, you know, and I think that one of my great mentors was Sam Lacy, the great Sam Lacy, sports writer. And one of his great things for me, he died when he was 100 years old. But I would, when I got old, I would call him about issues, particularly, and he'd say, no, no, the guys who are like now, these white guys who are taking these sort of liberal roles, that's not who he was in 1955. You know, that wasn't, well, who, that's not the position he took in 1957. And people are chameleons. And so, and I think, Walter, you touched on, like, today we have all this outpouring of affection and love. And it always happens when people are dead, you know. And I'm like, well, what would you think about him when he opposed, when he wasn't going to fight in the war? What was Bill Clinton saying in 1967? And you're right, now he's going to give the eulogy. And I guess we have to sort of honor the people's wishes and just sort of move on. But it's amazing.
Well, have to honor and respect what people want to do.
Yeah,
but at
absolutely.
The same time, we're intelligent creatures, yeah. And we can make assessments and analysis about that behavior.
Right.
See, and that's probably part of the problem. You know, we don't want to look at the behavior and say that is what it is. Right. We want to romanticize this whole thing about Ali. He's the greatest, you know.
Right.
But when I lived with him, in my experience, he wasn't the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
Not by any stretch of the imagination. But to a few people, most of the people, he was not considered. They had problems still calling him Cassius Clay.
That's right.
He had to resist that.
When did you see that change from people starting to glorify him, starting to give him this credit? Around what time did you see that change occur?
I'll comment on that. You know, black folks in America didn't start calling themselves black until John Kennedy called them black. So what we're doing, we're following the racist pattern. They dictate and they confiscate not only people, but ideas, concepts, and beliefs. And that's what it, so when they flipped on that, we flip with them. So Dr. Martin Luther King was supported in his struggle by who? Dale, Harry Belafonte. Wasn't invited to his funeral, but George Bush was.
Mm.
Now, this is deep.
Mm.
What we're talking about is deep.
Mm.
It's psychological, and it addresses the psychic of black folks. If I were to respond to that, I would respond to it, and this is just directed back at Leon, and I appreciate the position he was talking about, the actual exposure. However, there may be greater exposure, but one of the subtle aspects of it, and this is Neely Fuller. And I'm going to quote Neely Fuller. Neely Fuller said, if you don't understand white supremacy and racism and how it works, everything else you understand will only confuse you.
You're not going to understand nothing.
All right? So the follow-up on that is that looks like something to do for exposure. But it also says that this is who must validate this experience.
Right.
See, on a whole nother level, it's saying, this is who will validate this experience, President Clinton. Now y'all all get on board, because that's just my perception of it. And there are other perceptions of it, but racism is tolerant when it's helpless, and in this situation, it's helpless. Ali made all of them helpless, but they never wanted to acknowledge that helplessness. And when I was in that period of time that I'm experiencing, and I just wanted you to say one thing because I want you to understand this, and this is basically what I want to say, because this is who I am. And I just want to say, and I respect all human beings.
This is Walter Beach, by the way.
But this is me. As an African black man, my hypocrisy manifests as silent rage. I was 9 years old, man. My mother had to put a dress on me, get me out of Mounds, Illinois, so I wouldn't be lynched. I was 9 years old. I was 32 years old playing professional football with the Cleveland Browns, and the owner told me I couldn't read a book. See, that's my experience. So my experience is different than these young guys' experience, and I appreciate their experience, but I cannot be silent around this stuff because I breathe it and feel it. So to me, it's always impressed and pressing me. But to someone else, like my son, and I was telling you, like my son, who grew up in Shaker Heights in Cleveland because I was playing and he lived in a nice house and had the swimming pool, race didn't mean nothing to him. It meant nothing to him. But it meant everything to me. So when I look at my son, and you look at me, based on our experiences, you get two different aspects of it. And out of that becomes that hypocrisy. See, so I'm a hypocrite often. So I'm a hypocrite because sometimes I don't challenge that system. That's hypocritical. And for people who understand psychology and psychiatrists, it's schizophrenic behavior. So often black people manifest schizophrenic behavior. You drinking Coca-Cola, but you tell me you love Pepsi.
Isn't it also survival a little bit?
Right. Part of the same thing. It's part of the same thing. And that's what we have to acknowledge. And it's all right to be like my son, but it's also all right to be like me or be like Ali. So that's what this particular system has created. All of this is the offspring.
Let me ask you as well. I mean, I want to get back to something you said, because I want to be clear. We were talking about Clinton speaking. And I think this is a good, healthy debate. How do you feel, Walter, about Clinton speaking? I think you bring up a great point about what that means and the larger visibility. What do you think? What do you think about him speaking?
Like I said, I see it as it angers me. So I'll tell you why it angers me. And it's got something to do with what you was talking about. You know, where were you when this was going on? And you have to understand, where is the sincerity? Where is the sincerity of that? Look, there's a gentleman they call Larry Holmes. There's a gentleman they call Jim Brown. There's a gentleman they call Will Chamberlain, not Chamberlain, Russell. I just told y'all about Harry Belafonte. They didn't even allow him in King's funeral because they had to have that other individual who was the president there. But Harry Belafonte wasn't there. But that is part of what I'm saying we suffer from. So there's a consequence of slavery. It's a consequence of racism. Things change people psychically. Because the incubation is different. There's a different incubation period. My response would be, how dare you come here to eulogize? How dare you get it? See the whole thing, man. I was going to go on to something about this Trump thing, but people don't understand how deep that is.
Well, at least they're not asking him to eulogize it.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
That would just shut everything down.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, man.
You know what? You're right. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me either.
They did go and get, you know, some try to get a response from Trump, and Trump praised Ali. So, I mean, it just shows you that in one breath, you know, someone, you know, all of a sudden everybody loves Ali and loves what he stood for, and we know that's nonsense.
Because what he did, he spoke to the truth on this universe and on this planet. He said, man, ain't none of this stuff y'all doing right. Because we all human beings. We're all creatures of God. And if you violate that principle, you may get away with it for a while. But he said, no, it's going to clear up. It's going to clear up. Because that's the reality of it, man. We've just seen, and I don't want to be preaching on it, but we've just seen some people in this country endorse an individual. Why? Because the presidency in the United States of America is no longer the commander-in-chief. Hail to the chief, they don't play no more like they used to play it. Because an individual in Congress called the president of the United States a liar. And this country accepted that. And when you accept that, an individual who's one of the brightest human beings that went through that university, if Obama had spit on the streets, man, you would have known it. That's how pure he is. And that's how intelligent he is. Now we want a cat that ain't even intelligent. Because they violated the presidency. So we'll have anybody be a president now. It used to be if you didn't graduate from one of them universities and then bought in Phi Beta Kappa, you couldn't even run for president. But now anybody can run for president. Just sell some property.
To me, I remember the last time I really had because Parkinson is just, man, you talk about a disease, man, I don't think there's any great disease to have. But, you know, it just, they say you become a prisoner in your own body. You know, you could tell that the mind is there. You just can't, but we were talking and, you know, I was in this hotel room for some reason. And then Millie said,
What's your name?
So I kind of knew it. I said, Bill Rhodes. He said, no, what's your real name? That's your slave name. And so I just kind of laughed. But even then, it's like, he said, it's about, I'm just keeping you in check, Mr. New York Times and Mr. whoever the hell you are. What's your name? And sometimes even when I go into a Starbucks and they say, your name, please. And I'll say X. Well, I don't know. I don't know. What's your name? You know? It was a young person and as a young black person, they'll kind of get it. After she said, do you really know your name? You know, that's the whole point. But anyway, so I guess my lasting thing with Ali is that he was just really, no matter, you know, yes, people loved him all over the world. That's great. But he was a brother. He was a black man. He would let you know that I'm a black man and I'm proud of it and I'm not for racism. And you're right. And what we hear now is people still dancing around that. Well, he transcended racism. No, the fuck he did not. You know. So anyway, that's one of the things I'll take away. And I guess I remember when Coltrane died and people would say, hey, Train lives. And when Bird died, my father just said, well, Bird lives. And that's something profound. As we lose people, your dad, your parent, they live. And that's the whole point of a person's life, is basically, though, even they pass, that spirit lives. So that's what I say with Ali, that Ali lives.
This is the final point that I'll make. It's the last thing that's ever been said to me by Muhammad Ali. And he said one thing to me. He said, man, just be a black man. That's all he said. He said, just be a black man. You got to do nothing else. Just be a black man.
Just be who you are.
That's right. Just be who you are. So just be all that other stuff, you know. It really doesn't. Just be a black man.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 11th, 2016. So I have been told. Compensatory call-in. Feel free to chime in if you have comments you would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Last segment there, ode to black journalists. Bill Roden, the author of $40 Million Slave, he did that program just a couple of days ago talking about the legacy of Muhammad Ali. I had been waiting to hear his commentary. I had read his post and shared it on my Facebook page. I tweeted it, his commentary in the New York Times about Muhammad Ali being an ungentrified black man. And I was waiting to see if he was going to talk about it in detail on his radio broadcast, which he did. And you heard the legend, Mr. Walter Beach III. I had not heard from him before. Former football player, as you heard, on the Cleveland Browns, a teammate of Jim Brown. But he was the one that quoted Neely Fuller Jr. during the segment. I was stunned. Like, even before it got to that point, just listening, I was really appreciating their commentary, talking about racism pretty honestly, and Muhammad Ali and his legacy and what they've seen over the past week, and Bill Clinton speaking at the memorial service yesterday. But then when he referenced Neely Fuller, I was like, wow, incredible. Would love to get him on the program. If anybody has hookups to Mr. Beach, I believe he's in the Cleveland area still. If folks have any information, would be grand to get him on the program. But I didn't realize until after I heard that segment, I did some digging and posted some other articles that he's written. He's written a book about his experience in racism as well. But he is 83, so he is in the same age range as Mr. Fuller. It wouldn't even surprise me if he has met Mr. Fuller or heard him or whatever, all of the above. But things made a lot more sense once I found out, like, oh, okay, he's about the same age as Mr. Fuller, and why he just spoke honestly, made it plain some of the views that he had about everything that he's observed over the past week. But I thought that was just a really outstanding segment, and was glad to be able to include it. That was a little longer than the segments that I normally play, but I felt that was worth it given the gravity of Muhammad Ali and what he attempted to do to fight against racism, and then what they had to say. Bill Roden as well, awesome commentary. Power of black journalism. Quick comments before I hit the phone lines to get folks to share their thoughts, commentary. If anybody would like to support the broadcast on my wish list at Amazon.com, it's under Gus T. Renegade. The book, The Hanging of Angelique, The Untold Story of Canadian Slavery and the Burning of Old Montreal. This is a black author. She's a professor in Canada. She should be on the program later this month. If anybody wants to invest, used copy of that would be great. I'm always down for used copies, too. I don't say that very often. I have it written on my wish list next to the books, but I'm always about used books, especially if it's a white person, but even if it's a non-white author, you know, to try and save coins. I'm not snobby about books. As long as I can read the material, it is all good. Not that I'm upset if I ever get new books and that sort of thing, but always about saving coins. Used books is great. If anybody wants to nab a used copy of The Hanging of Angelique, that would be great. Afua Cooper, she will be visiting us later in the month, black professor in Canada, to talk about racism in that part of the world. Moving forward, some of the other quick things I wanted to make sure to touch on. Number one, the segment where they were discussing the incident of white terrorism at the Starbucks right here in Seattle. I'm not a big coffee fan, but I think I've been to that coffee shop that they were at, if I heard it correctly. I think where they were talking about where this is at downtown. They do have a ton of Starbucks in Seattle. I think this is the home where Starbucks was founded. So, I mean, they're like everywhere. They're more Starbucks than stop signs. But I think I've been to the one that they were talking about. At any rate, many things stood out to me about that segment. I posted online when someone shared it that I cannot imagine if someone had came in and yelled faggot or some what they call homophobic slur at a particularly if it was a white person. I could not imagine the whole restaurant just sitting in silence and nobody saying or doing anything. I could not imagine that happening. I could be in error, but I strongly suspect it would have been a much more vigorous, assertive response, particularly here in Seattle from what I know of this area. I also thought it was a massive act of racism. There were two people in this incident, Dr. Bob Hughes and Yashika Harden, two professors, faculty members at two distinct academic institutions here in Seattle. It seems like she was the primary target, but she said that this white terrorist spit on both of them. Somehow the white person ends up conflating that this is an act of racism and sexism. I have no idea how that would be an accurate description of this incident if he is yelling nigger this and nigger that, even if he says nigger bitch, and I'm just quoting because that's what he said, even if he's saying that, if he's spitting on two black people, a male and a female, I have no idea how that becomes now an incident of sexism. And that's just, in my view, white people do this all the time. They do not want to say that the dominant problem on the planet, the war that is being waged, is white terrorism, period. They got to make sure that we throw in, oh, yeah, it's ageism and ableism and homophobia and sexism and any and everything else so that we can just confuse non-white people so that they are not clear about what is happening on this planet. Now, if the non-white female, if she had said that, I would have had the same position that I have now. I wouldn't argue with another victim of racism, particularly after what she experienced. But a white person, that should be contested. In my view, that is a gargantuan act of white supremacy, and it defies logic. If you're telling me he spit on both of these black people, how is this an incident of sexism? Male and a female were victimized here. Act of racism. Moving forward. And even before I leave that incident, didn't they just have, we had Dr. Wells and she talked about it, didn't Starbucks just do the whole campaign last year for like 5 minutes about, talk about race, you know, when you come in to our stores, ask your barista, talk about race, wasn't that a big to-do? If folks remember that, and I say it was like 5 minutes, is literally, that's about how long it lasted. They did it, people complained. I think some of the barristers complained. Customers even were like, you know, I'm just coming to get my latte. I'm not coming to have social commentary with somebody making, you know, whatever, Starbucks employees, whatever their wages are. I just want my coffee quickly so we can, you know, keep it moving. I can get on with the rest of my day. But they canceled it, I think, like within a day or two or what have you. But then they just have that campaign. I would think, you know, anybody in a Starbucks, like, hey, this is an environment of social justice. We're not going to tolerate this. Everybody should be up and ready to borrow. But I didn't even hear that brought up. And again, Starbucks is founded here in Seattle. I didn't even hear that mentioned. I'd seen this report a couple times. They had this in the Seattle Times, this incident last week. And then they had it on the Seattle Public Radio this week as well. But I didn't even hear that referenced at all. Now, moving forward. I always say on the compensatory call-in, or I've been saying, I guess, for a few months now, no metaphors. This week gave some just outstanding illustrations of the incorrectness of metaphors. And it happens all the time. I could pull these, you know, daily. I could pull them from people that call in and make their analogies and metaphors and comparisons and all that stuff, because it's all the time when people talk about racism, white supremacy. For people who tuned in from the very beginning this week, the whole kerfuffle at the Cincinnati Zoo where Harambe the gorilla was shot and killed, when the prosecutor came out this week and announced that they were not going to prosecute the mom, and he said, well, it would be like, now that's a simile, but the same thing. That's just the specific type of metaphor he invoked. But he said it would be different if, like, you know, the mom was in the bathroom smoking crack and her child was just running around and ran in the gorilla pit. That would be different, and then maybe we could prosecute, but that was not the case here. And I immediately stopped, like, what in the world? A black family that has been persecuted for a week, now it's, well, you know, if they were smoking crack like all of us thought they were doing, then yes, we would prosecute. But since apparently there's no evidence that she was smoking crack, we will not prosecute. These type of metaphors, I can, again, this is another one I would assert, if this had been a white family, I cannot imagine that being the comparison. We're not going to charge them. They weren't smoking crack, as all black people do, but they weren't. So we're not going to charge them. Metaphors, and I, in my opinion, I think when white people, the racism, white supremacy is such a part of your thinking, your actions, your behaviors, your emotions, the environment, everything about this planet is saturated in it. If sometimes I think white people, when they're just talking, they're not able to filter out what they're going to say. And I think some of this speech was extemporaneous. He was just up talking, giving the press conference that they were not going to press any charges. And that's just, you know, I'm talking about niggers, so what do I associate with black people? Niggers, fried chicken, smoking crack, yeah. So they weren't smoking crack, so we're not going to press charges. That was one. The second, this was written. This was not in the audio segment. There was another black journalist. But there was an article in the Seattle Times, a week ago. They were talking about the whole Roots thing. And I think people were aware of Snoop. And I think even some other black people had said that they were not going to watch Roots, that they thought this was nonsense and just to keep forcing images of enslaved black people on us, and they weren't going to participate in all this. So Leonard Pitts Jr., he wrote an article that was syndicated. It was published in the Seattle Times, and he was talking. It was basically a response to Snoop Dogg's boycott of the new Roots. I'm not going to read the whole thing. So he says, "Allow me to share some Wikipedia research. No, that's not a definitive source, but the results were still persuasive. Know how many productions, TV, feature film, and documentaries about the 246-year epic of American slavery I was able to identify? 46. That's since Birth of a Nation in 1915. By contrast, I found 136 American productions about the 12 years of the Holocaust, which ended in 1945. Somehow, I have never once heard the complaint that there are too many Holocaust movies being made, and it is simply inconceivable to me that a Jewish entertainer would say something so asinine." I will stop there. Mr. Pitts is a victim of racism, black male. He has VGQ, as does Snoop. That is not the point. The point is the metaphors. This metaphor comparing how, quote-unquote, Jewish people respond to the Holocaust films in comparison to black people's response to slave films, that metaphor, null and void. It is totally incorrect to compare the two, in my view. This is why I believe, and this is another reason, the whole Jew thing is incorrect as well. People use the term Jew as though it's interchangeable with white people. They're acting as though there are no non-white people who also identify as being Jew or Jewish. Clearly, that is the case. You heard one of the audio clips. Sammy Davis Jr., we have had some on the program. That is a massive problem. It is incorrect. We should not be talking as though everyone who identifies as a quote-unquote Jew is a white person. That is simply not accurate. So, if we're talking about white people who identify as Jewish, if they were still in Auschwitz, if they were still having Hitler's foot on their neck, if they were still having to run from those ovens, I'm quite sure they would have a very different perspective about someone blasting films up, dramatizations of them being shoved in ovens. I'm quite sure they would have a very different perspective if that's what they were still being subjected to. It is an astronomical difference when you are still being subjected to terrorism as opposed to, oh, we are reflecting on something that we experienced long time ago, relatively speaking, of course. We're reflecting on that, and we want to make sure that we remember that and, you know, keep that as a part of something, a significant historical event for us. Those are two totally different things. If I have to watch the 5th, 6th, 7th version of Roots, followed by The Underground, followed by 12 Years a Slave, followed by Django Unchained, followed by the latest snuff flick of Michael Brown or Sandra Bland or Akai Gurley or Tamir Rice or Marlene Pinnock or Miriam Carey or insert name, I think you would have a very different feeling about seeing an endless parade of dramatizations and real-life snuff films of black people being bludgeoned and executed. I could be in error, but I don't think so. On that note, please, no metaphors for the compensatory call-in. Even some of you all, callers, the metaphors are just out of control. And sometimes they're metaphors that cannot be verified. People are making comparison between things where there's no way to make an accurate quantitative analysis to even see if what is being said, if what's being compared if it is even logical, if it even makes sense. And I think sometimes people just say these metaphors to see how exciting or how emphatic they can make their statements so that people know that they have really strong convictions about what they're saying. We should really strive for accuracy and truth above all, as opposed to trying to get your mic drop on so that people are like, wow, that brother dropped it. Did you hear what that sister? Make sure that whatever the number one priority should be, let me make sure that what I'm saying is accurate before I get into trying to make it sound really emphatic and poetic, whatever my view is going to be on racism. Whatever your thoughts are, please let us refrain from using metaphors for the compensatory call-in. Thank you kindly. You can use them other programs or whenever else you are out and about talking about racism. But for today, the Saturday call-in, no metaphors, please. If folks could keep it to 5 minutes, whatever you have to share regarding the news clips or anything else, that would be great. We don't have workplace racism, so there should be ample time if you want to comment later and add other things. But if you could do 5 minutes, that would be great. If you know you're in a loud environment with noise, television, or other things that are just going to disrupt the audio quality of the program, if you could use your mute button, that would be most appreciated. The number again is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Feel free to chime in.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
I was calling to give my emphasis on, you know, blacks in society. We feel like we are a part of other group of people when we call ourselves non-white. We use terms like not white. What I'm trying to say is that I don't agree with that term because I feel it's like other groups who are classified as Indians, Asians, and Arabs, they don't technically go through racism to the extent that we go through. So I agree with what we should be labeling ourselves as is white, non-white, and black, because we are the greatest victims of racism. And I feel as if these other groups engage in white supremacy against us. Like Peter Liang, George Zimmerman, these cases that truly affect black people. And most black people are quick to, you know, jump to the sides of other groups, but these other groups have not been, you know what I'm saying, as proactive as we have been in the fight of white supremacy. And although I do not agree with Mahatma Gandhi, he did say, along with Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, along with Isaiah Washington in a recent interview, that it is the Negro's job to bring justice to this planet. And I don't really think that other groups of people have become mature enough to prove that they are worthy in a fight against white supremacy. I remember in an interview that you had with J.S. Sanderesh, you even made a statement. I'm not going to be as accurate as you were in the video. You said that blacks feel as if other non-whites have not been as proactive or has engaged enough, and blacks develop a mentality, well, you know what, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. We are going to do this on our own. I don't know if you remember that, but I remember hearing the interview. I mean, it's not as accurate as you said it, but I have a glimpse of how you said it. So what do you think about that? What do you think about when I say that, you know what I'm saying, there's a such thing as white, non-white, and black? Because when we lump ourselves into the non-white category, we are then putting ourselves in categories with people who are not as affected by the system of white supremacy, or who have not been treated to the extent like black people across the world have. other groups of people in other countries, in non-white countries, you notice how black people tend to be treated the same way by other groups how they are in European countries. Why do I say that? Because there is a, and I'm not disagreeing with any shadow of a doubt, white supremacy has affected the lives of all groups of people across the planet. But what I am saying is that other groups of people who are classified as not black but non-white have engaged in the same systemic practices that is very similar to the tactful practices of white supremacy against black people. They have not engaged in the fight to end white supremacy, nor have they been as dedicated as we have been. Jaya Sundaresh even said herself, I don't know if her name is Jaya Sundaresh or Jaya Sundaresh, she even said that when she try and talk about race, most Asians or East Asians or Indians do not want to engage in that subject, especially when it has anything to do with black people. And it plays out in society in many aspects. All these groups of people, they are allowed into the white circles. They get along with white people very well, you know what I'm saying? But I noticed that when black people tend to try to inject themselves in that atmosphere, they are somehow rejected. No other group of people had drugs put in their communities. No other group of people had their economies destroyed like black people. Dr. Claudia Anderson even said himself, other groups of people have access to capital with the exception of black people. Never mind the fact how Asians set up ordinances within the black community to stop the rise of black businesses. Never mind how the Hispanics are here to replace us and how they make and how they like to make stirs like black people are lazy. Never mind the fact how Indians are discriminated against black people every chance they get. So the reason why I say I would agree with the term called non-white, white, and black, because I feel as if black people is in a position that is separate from the term non-white, because our position against the racism, white supremacy, is very unique compared to other people. And I think that it is very important because I'm not going to say that there are no non-white people out there who are not black that is in the fight against white supremacy. I just don't see enough of them. Like, the motivation is it's not as concentrated. And that's what I wanted to say. Thank you, Gus.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sir, it's certainly VGQ. That is your perspective. I would say I think we have a – I'll just stand by my record with the program. I think we have been pretty explicit in stating that black people are subjected to vastly more severe levels of white terrorism than anybody else. I think we've been pretty articulate, pretty consistent in stating that over years on the – even the program that you mentioned with Jaya Sundaresh from 2 years back when we were talking about Michael Brown. And – this is going to come up again on Tuesday. Kathy Dang, she is a non-white, non-black female, quote-unquote Asian. She will be here to talk about that exact subject. So I have nothing to say, as we will be talking about that on Tuesday. One thing I would say, I think you could probably make a pretty easy case that there are a lot of black people that are not very interested in fighting against racism. I will not call names, but I don't think it would be very difficult to, everybody could probably amass their own list of 50, 100, 1,000 black people that are not doing very much to fight against racism, unfortunately, including some of our family members, and I probably would say it's probably not that
accurate. Take them out. Put the other ones in.
It is probably not that accurate to say that quote-unquote non-white people, non-white, non-black people are doing the exact same thing as whites. Because that would mean that they are racist white supremacists. And I've concluded that you have individuals who are white and individuals who are not white. Even if you are a non-white, non-black person, it probably is not accurate to say that you are doing the same thing as white people, even though you might be engaged in similar behaviors, thoughts, speech, emotions, that sort of thing, particularly with regards to mistreating black people. But I don't think their behaviors are identical. If they were, they would not be subject to white supremacy. That could be an error. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary?
Can I be heard?
Hello, can I be heard?
I guess we'll nab Puff, then we'll get a retired firefighter.
Sorry about that, my man in Florida. Greetings, everybody. This is Puff. Just have a couple of quick comments. I wasn't able to call in last week, and I wanted to bring this up last week about Muhammad Ali. I listened to the people, you know, that were commenting about his life and, you know, absorbed those comments. And, you know, not to get sidetracked, but about this man that was a football player around the time, and he said he was able to give his son this kind of lifestyle, and so his perspective on racism is not his father's perspective on what racism. And I can understand that to a degree, but they not. It's just he admitted, you know, on the thing that he did not pass the knowledge of racism down to his children, and they might have a different perspective on that. But at any rate, I wanted to get on Muhammad Ali and just say briefly that is an act of racism that I watched here. They had his funeral on TV. Now contrast that with, you know, before when he refused to go to the draft, and people were arguing in the 80s when I was going to college that this is why he got sick with Parkinson's and stuff, because, you know, he refused the draft. And hello?
We can hear you.
Oh, okay. He refused to go to the draft, and, you know, he went to prison for that. I mean, for several years. And then now, you know, of course, he's lauded and, you know, and this type of thing. But it's like, well, where were you when, you know, and Bill Clinton is, you know, endorsing this person, the former U.S. president. But, you know, contrast that with years ago, you know, it's different, man. I mean, you know, he went to prison for that, and he lost his boxing license, and they wouldn't give him a boxing license until, you know, maybe a year or so is why he got out of prison. I think I was listening to the show later, you know, that show that you guys did on Saturday, that the retired firefighter said he came there, you know, because he wasn't employed or something like that. And he wasn't boxing, and so he came to his neighborhood and this type of thing, you know, different things to earn money, that type of thing. And it's just all in their hands. It just shows, you know, the power of white supremacy. It's just all in their hands, you know, and they could turn around at any point and give him his boxing license back and allow him the ability to earn money. It's that type of thing. You know, it's a yay or nay type situation. Same thing with, well, we were not going to compare metaphors, but, you know, when they shot that gorilla, that is a, and you know, I was looking at that, you know, with the Harambe situation a few weeks ago. I was looking at that, you know, while they were making that decision. And, you know, they had just mentioned on the news that gorilla, the previous week, had been celebrated like it was his 17th birthday or his 17th year at the zoo or something. Hell, they were celebrating him, and now, you know, the next week he gets killed. You know, it's just all in their hands. It just shows me that type of thing. And then one more comment about the environment, about the Starbucks, those people in Starbucks. I find that, you know, that's par for the course. I mean, these things can happen at any time, you know. I really hate that happened to those, you know, people, you know, there. But the thing of it is, you know, white people don't like to be, and this is a pattern of their behavior. You know, when it's all white people and they feel like they can get away, quote unquote, with anything, you know, in their environment, But when it's more black people around, or like if somebody would have said something, then they would have jumped on the bandwagon and said something also. So it won't look like all white people are not racist. This happened to me. Not I didn't get spit on or anything like that. But, you know, several years ago when my car stopped, I think I needed another battery or something like that. No one stopped to help me, and I was in Frisco, Texas, and that's mostly a white area. And so, you know, this black mechanic stopped and helped me. And then when just not even 2 minutes after I got he was trying to get my car started and push it out of the intersection, he was like the only one. He said, steer it this way. I was like, okay. And then a white man stopped, and then some more white people stopped. So they weren't going to stop at first because I was there about 20 minutes before this black mechanic stopped to help me. And that's a pattern of their behavior. And that's all I wanted to say. Go ahead.
Retired firefighter, did you have commentary?
Yes. To the lady before me, ladies are always first, so I definitely don't mind if the lady goes before me. My comments. I totally agree with your analysis of the comments that were made in response to Mr. Brodus, better known as Snoop Dogg, that was not as accurate as a comment that could have been made, because first and foremost, the people who are putting these Holocaust movies on are white people, and they always triumph in the end, regardless of their pitfalls or anything, any type of tragedy that took place with them. They are going to indicate on that movie, if not in what we know as reality in itself, that we triumph because they are, from my understanding, identified as white people. So a lot of times non-white people get that confused with this thing about a Jew, and it's done on purpose to confuse people. Walter Beach, very good football player, being I'm stating that from being a coach also. But Walter Beach has been less confused on the system of racist white supremacy and been involved for a very long time. And like Jim Brown and that quote-unquote iconic picture that you have on Facebook, he was always doing what we are understanding about. I saw him on a clip years ago where he was on an air flight with the team, Cleveland Browns, on the way coming back from a game, and he was reading message to the black man. And I believe it was one of his coaches or somebody on the plane called him up to try to chastise him on reading this book. We're talking about workplace racism in this case also. And he basically told, I don't know if it was the coach or the owner, that, hey, you don't tell me, you may tell me what to do as far as policies and procedures on the job, as far as an employee on the job as a football player, but you don't tell me what to read, and I'm going to tell you on reading. So although they have power to mistreat you anyway, regardless of what he said, it just showed me the courage that he had during the time where he was making a very high salary during that time. It may not be comparable to what the athletes are making today, but it was still a pretty good salary during that time for whoever was making, and he didn't care so much about that to the standpoint that he's going to speak his mind and stand up for what he thought was correct. And he's been at it for a long time. And I'm looking at this picture, and I can count in that picture 3-4 black males who not only were great athletes, three or four of them were also considered the best at their sport. When you see Bill Russell, at that time he was still called Lew Alcindor. We know him today as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Willie Davis, who's in the Hall of Fame. Jim Brown, of course. Muhammad Ali, of course, is in his Sports Hall of Fame. But Bobby Mitchell. I mean, in other words, you have during that time some of the best people at their job who stood next to this man, which shows a great deal of self-respect, is what I'm saying. And I remember the comments that Jim Brown made in response to the interview, and how bold he was, and he was saying how constructive the meeting came out. And so it was something, you know, very much on a very high self-respect level. One thing that I've noticed through this whole period of time of Muhammad Ali's death, first of all, I don't put it past the races. They've been planning his death now for about 30 years. Really? They've been planning this day, these couple of days, for the past 30 years, as far as that's concerned. Muhammad Ali never had the opportunity to retire from what he was doing. For the most part, when you retire from boxing, you still, or professional sport, you're still pretty much a young person. And he never had time to retire from that profession and commit himself to directly speaking and or acting out the global system of racism from a counter-racist point of view. He actually had Parkinson's, which I wouldn't put it past white people in this world that in some kind of way they was able to induce him in some sort of way with that issue. But he never had time. He had the Parkinson's when he was still fighting. You can clearly hear it in his speech and his actions. And plus, he for a fight, you have to take a physical and whatnot. And it was indicated during that time. I've seen that in a couple of documentaries. And in turn, one thing you don't hear anything about directly out of these Billy Crystals and these what's the former president? I can't think of his name right now. But everybody know who we're talking about. Yes, Clinton and what you don't hear anything about the Nation of Islam. If it wasn't for the Nation of Islam and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we would not know anything about the person by the name of Muhammad Ali. Matter of fact, that wouldn't even be his name. It wouldn't even be his name, Muhammad Ali, if it wasn't. Now we can mention about also Malcolm X, but Malcolm X was primarily on his relationship with Muhammad Ali was due to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And so that is the focal point on where white people veer off. A certain level of white people wouldn't mind talking about Muhammad Ali from the standpoint of evading the draft. Why? Because a lot of them didn't want to go in it either. They just found it, as Muhammad mentioned, they just found different ways to get out of it. And most of them were, like Mr. Clinton did, was a cowardly way of getting out of it. A typical way that white people do, you know, to get out of things. But that's one thing to focus on, you know, when it comes to race. In other words, when it comes to race, especially from the way that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we have to factor in that this black male grew up in Cordell, Georgia, which is the same town where my mother So I know about the terrorism that took place during that time. Took place during that time with non-white black people, and what he was able to create and build upon and influence, the number of people he was able to influence, is unprecedented when it comes to counter-racism in this part of the world. And I truly admire him. And matter of fact, I've always heard from Mr. Fuller when he spoke about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, it's always been something very constructive. You know, when the subject matter of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad comes up, it's always been something constructive. My father was a member of the Nation of Islam, but I'm not saying it from a standpoint of I wanted to be a Muslim or anything like that. You know, but that to me is a striking fork in the road. Well, I'm using a metaphor. I'm sorry. It's the turning point, whereas whites are not going to endorse, and that's something I've been focusing on with this week concerning Muhammad Ali, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Other folks we have not heard from, if you all had comments here, feel free to share.
Good evening,
yep.
Everyone. Oh, go ahead.
It's okay.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. It's Karma. And hello, guests. Hello to all the other callers. And I wanted to give you guys an update, but I just want to give you some background real quick. I think that the 2 years I've taken off, and I think my approach is a little bit novel for the small community that I live in, because I really don't care that much about the white people. And when I took over, you know, being the head of their party, they all left me. They abandoned me. They took all the money out of the treasury. They refused to have to do anything. They scheduled me for parades, and I was the only person who showed up. I mean, they wouldn't give me the float, the banners. I mean, and I just carried on without them. And I think that this has confounded them. So that's pretty much been their attitude towards me. Why won't she stop? Why won't she give up? Why doesn't she beg us to come back? Why doesn't she care? So their number one thing right now is they want to build a huge jail. And, of course, they'll just be putting non-white people in it, and especially non-white black people. And I did let that our highest judge let him know that I'm going to be against the jail. And I'm going to explain it to everyone, and I'm going to invite Ms. Michelle Alexander to come and explain it to everyone in great length. So, you know, it's been hours trying to say, oh, the jail will be great. We're going to give everybody iPads, Karma. And we're going to make sure everyone gets college credits. And if they study enough, we're going to make sure they get movies on their iPads. It's going to be awesome. And it's just, you know, expecting, you know, it's just like normalizing a cell. But he spent hours just basically trying to tell me that this jail is going to be good. But this is the same thing that these people do. And they say, we're so civilized, we're just going to put you in a cage. It's going to be for the best. You're going to love it. It just says, you're going to love being in this cage. And it's the same thing they did to that gorilla. Instead of leaving him with his family in Africa, and they kidnapped him and put him in a cage, put a couple of extra bananas in it, a couple of trees, a little moat. Hey, look, it's great. You're in a cage. You love it, don't you? I mean, they just can't seem to see how psychopathic their behavior is with everything on our planet, with everyone on our planet. It's just, they just mess up every good thing. But, you know, and I just don't seek their approval. I just don't. I just go and do my own thing. So I wanted to let you know, as an update, that we're not going to be having him in jail, and I hope Ms. Alexander comes. The publicist says she thinks she can get it done, and I will wake my people up. But I wanted to let you know, somebody said they turned me into the Secretary of State, And I wrote the Secretary of State, and I said, I'd please like to have a copy of any complaint, the associated time and date, the person's name making the complaint, the exact body of the complaint, the supporting documentation, and or any corroboration regarding my performance. And they wrote me back and said, the Elections Division of the Office of the Secretary of State has reviewed its files and has not been able to locate any documents responsive to your request. So this white person this is an elected official, just came up to me and lied, saying I was probably in trouble with the Texas Secretary of State, just for the fun of it, just for the no good fun of it. I mean, just to be vicious so that I would concentrate on that instead of doing what I've been doing. So I just wanted to let you know how wicked that person is. And that is one of the people that I managed to unseat. So he will be replaced by a non-white person, which is great. And everyone is shocked about that. But he's got to go, and he just blatantly lied. The second thing is, it's one of the white people who did hang in there, who was always around. When I took the position, I remember her sitting in the backseat of my car on the way to a meeting saying, you know, Karma, I'm glad you're president. I don't have any problems with it at all. I don't see what all the fuss is about. I was shocked because I didn't know at that time, years ago, that there was a fuss, that the whole county was fussing. So here we are in a meeting. Now, even last weekend, she goes, you know, I just can't figure out why people won't come back. It is just a mystery to me. I mean, this woman knew that all the white people were upset before I even did. And she's sitting there looking at me and blinking her eyes in total innocence, saying, I just don't know why the white people won't come back. I just don't understand it. So, you know, they lie to you all the time, no matter how much they say they're on your side. And I think that I gave you all of the updates except for the thing about the dogs. And I'll tell you about that later.
Let us know how the Michelle Alexander thing goes. If y'all can do a video, maybe put it on YouTube or something, that would be grand. I'm sure folks would love to check out her presentation.
Oh, I think it would be great. Yep.
Let's see. The other female caller at 5992. Were you going to?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hello, everyone. And I really am taking in everything you guys have been saying tonight. I just want to make a couple comments. The one where Mr. Obama said, you know, he's been going across communities throughout the country and hearing that racism is getting better. I'm not a fan of TV. I mean, every now and then, my thing is YouTube. I think I get more education. But I don't remember hearing anything about him going to communities and, you know, talking about racism, or I don't know, I may be wrong, but I don't look at mainstream news either. So maybe it was on TV, I don't know, but I would think if he did that, it would definitely be somewhere on YouTube, or, you know, someone in the conscious community would have made some kind of remark on it. So I really don't know what he was talking about. And the young lady and the gentleman who got spit on and cursed at by the white guy. I agree with you, Gus, that if that had been some homosexual, then it would have been a whole different type of approach. But when it comes to black people being intimidated or tortured or whatever by white people, there is no bystander set. There isn't people just waiting to see what someone else is going to do. It just don't do anything. And the guy who was actually part of the conversation, and he said, well, if I was there, I don't think I would have did anything as well. No, he wouldn't. He wouldn't. And I'm sure they'll agree with you again. Maybe if there had been someone white and maybe somebody black had offended them or assaulted them in some way, maybe he would have, you know, responded. And one more thing about Bill Clinton. This guy, he really disgusts me. He always want to show up when it comes to black folks and, you know, who have been through a lot of trauma, like the Tuskegee experiment. Like last night we was reading a part in the book where, and I forgot what he actually said, because he said it was drowned out by the O.J. Simpson case. And now he shows up at Muhammad Ali's eulogy. Just, you know, like all politicians, You know, he is extremely self-serving. I don't believe nothing he says. I don't believe he cares one iota about Black people. I think he plays on the naiveness of a lot of Black people in America who still sees him as the first Black president, and in turn, probably, you know, give his wife a vote for presidency. So Bill Clinton, he just disgusts me. He is a pathological liar. I come the way back from the Monica Lewinsky case where he's telling people he didn't have sex with her and all the stuff. He just disgusts me. I just had to say it. If I was part of that Mr. Muhammad Ali's family or anything, I would have opposed him. I would have gave a lot of argument against him doing that eulogy because he had no right to be there at all. Again, he's, you know, all of them are self-serving. He's extremely self-serving, trying to get his wife elected for president, and that's the only reason why I see that he would do something like that. Thank you. Thank you for letting me talk.
For sure. Other folks that we have not heard from? Anybody on the line that we have not heard from yet?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Great commentary so far. I just wanted to say to the first caller that I agree that Black people definitely had it worse, and you should always use a specific figure. I think a lot of people use Black, non-white Black people, you know, when they refer to us. But, you know, by no stretch of the imagination did the other people get it any better. I mean, they got it pretty bad, too, when you study their history, from what white people did to them. I mean, China is an English word. I mean, they're walking around calling themselves plates and bowls. I mean, they've done a number to everybody in the world. So it's I think it is important to include them because I think Neely Fuller says it's only one race, the white race, and everyone else is, you know, in the same boat. So, you know, in order for us to beat this system, I mean, I'm with any one of us that do it. If the Chinese do it, I'm with them. If the Indians do it, I'm with them. I mean, someone needs to stop this, you know, but if we're all under it. And even though they've been bombarded with a lot of anti-Blackness in their countries through the images that come through the white mainstream media that they are privy to, just like if you turn on your nightly news, it's going to be a lot of anti-Blackness. You know, you're going to think the only people that commit crimes are Black people. So, you know, that's the same thing they're coming off with. And they also want to be Americans. And in order to be American, if you ask me, that means you want to be a white supremacist. And it's only one way to do that here is that's to put your foot on Black people's neck. So I think they learn that pretty quick when they get off the boat. You know, they get a little bit of acceptability. They get white validation from what they do to Black people. And I'll get into the some of the clips that you had. As for karma, as far as the prison, also another resource I think that she could probably use is Scotty Reed, because he does a lot of programs and things about abolishing prisons, especially private prisons. That's what it sounds like they're trying to build there. And he might have a coalition of people. I know he has a few people that he does the show with. That might have some advocacy groups that's against it that might be able to help you out. So I would check with Scotty Reed, the owner of Black Talk Radio. The Alley clip was great. I love the fact that the man said he prefers to be called the nigger. You know, I use the word nigger, that N-word. That don't mean nothing to me. I agree with it. Bill Clinton giving the eulogy, you know, ever since I've found out about MENA, Arkansas, all I can say is crack dealing Bill Clinton. You know what I mean? If you could name something that over the last 30 years that destroyed us worse than crack, I would be glad to hear what you think that might have been. But if you grew up in the 80s and 90s, man, I mean, if he's responsible for that, that's just no wonder he's in a Black church trying to ask for forgiveness every time he gets a chance, because, I mean, he destroyed a lot of lives. Billy Crystal's there. he's known for doing an imitation of Ali. I mean, he's not even like in the inner circle there. I mean, he made a little comedy career off of imitating a few black people good, you know. I like to point it out. I know Gus doesn't like it, but he is a Jew. And I when I say Jew, I mean a certain group of white people that could play black people very well. And I just wanted to say, lastly, talking about justice and leadership, I was listening to a clip on another podcast, and they put together a collection of clips that dealt with Gaddafi and his death, and it was very good. But one thing that stood out, and I mean, you talk about a just leader. He grew up in a tent in the middle of the desert in a village. And he rose to power to be the president of the country. And he vowed that everybody in his country would have a house before he moved his parents out their tent. And his father died before he got everyone a house. His mother was able to move into a house eventually. But, you know, the justice is people who have the least get the most resources. I think that he proved that. I mean, of all presidents I've heard of in the last, you know, in my lifetime, especially in this country, I mean, none of them ever put the bottom people first. And I thought that was remarkable. And I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Actually, before you comment, I would just, in the future, if folks would not attribute like, we're talking about racism, white supremacy, things shouldn't be coming down to like or dislike. It should be coming down to accurate or just this is something that this is not my view per se or what have you or my preference or what have you, as opposed to like and dislike. That's something I would want to encourage amongst non-white people as we proceed trying to figure all this out. Proceed, Roz.
All right. Thank you. Great comment just now. And greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Thomas in New York, Puff, Karma, everybody. It's great to hear all of you. And I agree with Thomas as well as far as the commentary. It's been really good to this evening and eye-opening. The first thing I wanted to speak on was the clip where the black female and the black male were spit on and basically assaulted in public, and no one did anything. It's that to me, because she did say that there were other black people in that space, and it was like a pretty much a mixed crowd as far as the different ethnic groups that were there, which included some white people. To me, that is a great example of the psychosocial conditioning of black people away from black self-respect, where we can see the most incredibly heinous things happen to another black person and, like, ignore it. And I understand that there are circumstances that, you know, that you might want to mind your business and keep out of it. But in most cases, if you're seeing a black female being assaulted, I mean, not even most, I would say it's just something that's intolerable to me. So even growing up, I remember there was a girl in our high school that was sexually assaulted on the train by a white male. She was very good looking. She called herself mixed. She was like black, Japanese, and Latino. And she was attractive, but essentially the guy like pulled her into his lap and started fondling her. And she told a bunch of my friends, and he got mashed out. Like, he was like mashed out by about 10 guys. And by the time the train opened at our stop, we got off of high school, he was completely out cold and pummeled. And we, you know, took her off the train and basically attended to her emotional needs. But he got it, and he got it good. So to me, the whole concept of, you know, seeing somebody in trouble and not doing anything is crazy, because we're white people. Man, all they need to do is see a white female cry and everything stops. It's like time stops. And these white people will just come to that person's rescue to see what's going on and literally do something about it in that moment. And I think that that's something we've lost over the years. Go back to, I'll just use Fannie Lou Hamer. She did not take crap. She went through a lot. They put her through the ringer. That's a metaphor, but they really put her through a lot. but she just didn't take any crap. And I mean, it's not saying that we do that, but it's something that I've seen progressively as I've grown up, that's just something that's just a normal thing. We see all kinds of stuff, and that speaks to what Gus talks about as far as seeing black death all the time. It just conditions us to accept anything as far as just what we're able to bear witness to and not be compelled to some form of action or intervention. The next thing I wanted to speak about was, the clip on the housing area, I think it's called Dixon in Toronto, Canada. At the end of the documentary, the discussion on the documentary, I found it telling that they said that they couldn't find any conclusive proof that there were any gangs in this area. And I really believe that whenever white people put millions of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars into a documentary or any sort of media to perpetuate an idea, because they're perpetuating the idea that there are gangs there. So just the fact that they would be willing to spend whatever money they spent to create that documentary, even though they said there's no conclusive evidence, would automatically drive public opinion in the direction that there are gangs there. And that is something that they use very often to demonize areas where there are a lot of non-white people, and most importantly, black people. And I just think that is a very nuanced but very powerful racist white supremacist tactic as far as perpetuating propaganda about the places where black people live or non-white people live. I don't use the term community very often because, to me, we don't have those. We just have areas where we live in clusters and groups of, you know, non-white people. But, you know, community indicates a common unity. And to me, the only thing we should commonly unify around is fighting racism, white supremacy. And that's not something that the vast majority of people are doing. So I don't think we have communities in that, in the truest sense of the word. The clip on Muhammad Ali and the fact that Bill Clinton was giving the eulogy at his funeral, just another blatant example of rhetorical ethics of white people. He's white. To me, you know, he's white. He's a white supremacist. His lifestyle is white supremacist. He's jailed and facilitated the death of many black people. He has, he's coated in the blood of black people. And I just believe that even this eulogy he provided at Muhammad Ali's funeral was really to help his wife get into office, or at least further use the tactic of white validation in order to fool black people into thinking that he really cares about black people through this eulogy at Muhammad Ali's funeral. And it would facilitate him helping Hillary get her spot as far as the presidency. So that's what I believe that was really truly all about. And lastly, I just wanted to speak to the black male who talked about black people basically separating ourselves from other non-white people. I totally understand that. And like I said, VGQ on that, I used to think that way at one point myself. But what I've come to really realize is that black people are the parents of all other people. And because we are the original human being, everyone who is of another ethnic group are essentially a degradation of the original black human model. And it's not a disrespectful thing, it's just the facts. And ultimately, when I use the term non-white, to me, anyone that's non-white is black. All they are a variant of black, and they have a lesser degree of melanin than us. So this is where the term yellow and red and all these other things come from. But in all honesty, they're nothing but variations of the original black model. They just don't know it. And I agree with Thomas in the sense that I would, you know, get with anybody who's willing to fight this system, because there are quite a few non-white, non-black people who know their history as far as understanding the fact that black people suffer the worst under the system. I remember Gus had an episode, he can probably pull it out of his memory banks because he's really good with that, but it was a late night episode where there was an Asian male himself and I think another black person, and the Asian male actually talked about the fact that black people suffer under the system more than anyone else. And the woman who he's going to be talking to this week, I think she was the last person to speak in that clip, because I pointed that out on that compensatory call, and that I thought her commentary was very good. And for her to be a non-white, non-black Asian female, she had a very good understanding of the system and was willing to do something in concert with assisting black people or working with black people. So definitely I understand why you feel that way. It is valid in its own way. But when you're able to see that these people are just offshoots of us who don't fully understand that they're just black people, they're just a different type of nigga to white folks. And when you get to that understanding, then it might kind of shift the consciousness, not in a way where you may not feel the same way, but just a deeper understanding of these people and the fact that, like Thomas said, they're just as damaged as we are. The difference is they just don't get it as bad as we do simply because they're not us. And with that, I'll mute my line, and thank you very much for taking my call, guys.
Yes, sir. Anybody that we have not heard from? We have folks with us that we have not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Peace to all the callers and to the host and to the platform. Really, I just wanted to comment on Muhammad Ali and his transition and basically how the system of racism, white supremacy was acting during this time period. I just found it significant that, you know, Muhammad Ali, despite it not being as popular as it seems to be a Christian or whatever, he was a Muslim or he was practicing Islam or whatever. He got his indoctrination in that through the Nation of Islam, which no disrespect to them or not saying that they didn't do the most, but they didn't necessarily give you the full version of Islam, so to say, that exists preferred to the secular version that they gave. But I just noticed that, you know, racism, white supremacy does take a very strong opposition stance towards Islam, seeing as though that racism, white supremacy flourishes through Christianity and Catholicism and things like that, where they got to portray themselves as the deity or whatever, as far as giving people a white Jesus or a European Jesus or whatever. And, you know, fundamentally, you know, the things about Islam definitely don't have room for racism, white supremacy to be practiced and for people to be worshiping a picture of a white Jesus or any Jesus. But, you know, and I just saw that as being something that takes away from the power of the alleged racist white supremacists in nine areas of people activity, religion being one of those areas. And, you know, it's just like we still live under the Christian Black Codes of 1724, even though we're in 2016. And in those Christian Black Codes, they clearly stated that the Jews were to be expelled and that all other forms of worship besides Catholic or Christianity was, you know, prohibited. So something that's like Islam was definitely scratched off the list. And this does go back to, I'm thinking, 1492, allegedly, when the Moors or whatnot, which were practicing Islam, when they got rolled down on from when they moved into Europe and Spain in 1711. So I'm just seeing a big connection between all of that and, you know, the fact that Muhammad Ali kind of gave light to something that seems so dark, you know. And they can play like ISIL and the Middle East type of Muslims or Islamic people as bad people or whatever, but then when the black people was doing it, we did it the best and, you know, we tried to do good with it, so they couldn't just make us out to be terrorists. And that's really all I wanted to say and add into the conversation. And once again, peace to everybody and to the platform.
Russ, can I comment on that?
Sure.
Yeah, I would like to say that Islam, the way it's practiced today, traditional form is, in a modern form, rather, is is a 1900 religion. If you're practicing it with a Quran, it was given to the Arab people after World War One to make them accept the Christian doctrine, because of course the beginning of the Quran is Noah, Moses, Adam, Eve, all of that. So they put them right under their umbrella. And if you get a book by Walter Williams, the historical is the history of Islam by Walter Williams, they'll tell you all of that. I had another comment later, guys. Thank
you. Can I make a comment?
Yes, I just wanted to point out the rise in metaphors under their umbrella, and then the previous caller shedding a light on something that was dark. It's been my experience frequently, religion, the metaphors, wow, lots and lots of metaphors start to be used when people start having conversations on religion, and I do not think that that is an accidental correlation. Retired firefighter, were you going to comment?
Yes, on the religion of Islam in this part of the world. Once again, if it wasn't for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the part that he played in counter-racism, not just counter-racism, but also instituting action, you know, building a program of counter-racist activity, generating high self-esteem into a lot of non-white black people, it would have been no more than about three or four black people in the religion of Islam if it wasn't for what we know today as the Nation of Islam at the time. Was there a lot of incorrect things going on within it? Yes. Also, just like any other organization, and I'm in agreement with Mr. Fuller of four-wallism, what he was identifying as four-wallism, the white supremacists would be in your organization within about 15 minutes. But with the advent of Mr. Muhammad introducing into a religion counter-racist codification and action, as I mentioned before, that's what was attractive to non-white black people. To join that particular religion. And no one really has the place to say that, well, they're so and so is not practicing the religion that we, I mean, even with Christianity, different versions of it, you know. So no one can say, just like with Christianity, there's different versions of Christianity. No one can say that that there is some different opinion of Islam that can't be accepted as such. And as I'm once again, I'll go back and say again in the end that if it wasn't for Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his ideas and thoughts on counter racism, it'd have only been about five black people that would join anything got to do with Islam in this part of the world, to put it that way, in this part of the world. Thank you.
We have about 20 minutes left in the program. I think somebody might need to change the battery in their smoke detector. I think I'm hearing the beep. At any rate, we have about 20 minutes left in the broadcast. If folks have commentary, they want to make sure they share. Other things that stood out over the past 7 days don't necessarily have to be from the audio clips or things that have been discussed so far in the broadcast. I know the Brock Turner situation got a lot of attention, where white people acted like they were concerned about a victim of rape who I believe was a white woman, even though they did not identify the victim, which is standard. But I have a difficult time after watching the Daniel Holtzclaw situation. I have not seen where white people are really concerned about black victims of rape, male or female. But I know that did get a lot of attention this past week. Do folks have any other commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I was thinking of when you had you brought out how that conflation is used, racism and sexism, and I was thinking of like how nobody responded and defended the victims of racism, and I'm quite sure there were a lot of females or, you know, white females in there that did, you know, nothing to respond, and that's because that was focused on them not being white. So I think that would have been an awesome question to ask that. I think, was that a white person doing that interview, I think, or was that a non-white person?
It was a white male. He identified as white.
Oh, see, so, yes, I was thinking, yeah, like, they like to bring in other terms and words to minimize the seriousness of racism. So, yeah, that was a very good point. And, you know, I thought about the Black Lives Matter slogan. And, you know, I was thinking that that was going to probably come up, but it didn't. But I thought that was significant about how he said he wouldn't, like, you know, admittedly, he said he wouldn't really do anything himself. So I thought that was very telling. He might as well have admitted that he was pretty much a white supremacist, but I don't think he would go that far. But I wanted to also point out that I think it was a segment about the school student, the young girl, had received the notes, the racist notes. I had also read that it was a second grader, I think somewhere up in Michigan, who had found a racist note in the cubby. It was like, I guess because it was the last week of school this week, and the note said something about, we only want white tenants in our community, and we don't want to go to school with Negro wrongs. And from what I looked at, it looked like it was something wrote by a little kid, you know, I guess I'm an 8-year-old. So, you know, it's not high school or middle school. Start way in elementary. So the article said that they was trying to analyze the writing that was on the paper. And I guess they asked the students in the classroom, and nobody admitted to writing the note. So apparently they got the students to write some kind of sympathy letter, I guess, to the student. So I'm thinking, man, like, I'm guessing that same student who wrote that wrote the nice letter to, I guess be kind and, you know, I guess, understanding to the black students. And I think the teacher was black, too. So there's a lot of confusion, obfuscation. So, yeah, that was very interesting. And that's all I had.
The whole Starbucks situation, number one, I always think that those sort of incidents, massive episodes of terrorism, but I think it's important, even reminding me when we had the white female guest on the program, Susan, I'm just forgetting her last name briefly, but when she was insisting that racism is not terrorism, or at least the form that it is now, contraire, mon frère, that is terrorism, in my opinion. But I think it's important because that sort of thing, in my view, it seems like it's happening at an increasing rate, where it's happening more frequently. And that sort of thing can happen at any moment. That's why I always emphasize it's such a good idea. It's just in terms of being codified to understand wars being waged against us so that you kind of regularly have your guard. Well, I won't say that. So that you're just paying attention to what's happening around you and not functioning like we are in a system of justice, that people are out to treat you well and do correct by you, because that's just not the world in which we live. It's unfortunate, but that's the way we need to be thinking. Another reason why I suggest that you probably should make it a practice to be sober if you're going to be out in public so that you can be thinking clearly. At any rate, I had talked to Mr. Fuller about incidents like that because they, you know, have happened regularly since we've been on the air. And he said he had two different suggestions. His one was, if you're in that sort of situation, run, like, immediately. Just get as soon as you hear someone is yelling, nigger this and nigger that and rah, 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 run. Grab your belongings, like, because things
quick, before you know it, can go real bad. And I mean, we say real bad like someone has died or someone is in need of serious medical attention. Just immediately get out of the area. His recommendation at that time, it wasn't with this specific situation, was if it's a female being attacked, if anything, help her to get out of that environment. Like, ma'am, let us go immediately. We can call the police as we are leaving. That was one. His other response was, because there were people who said the same thing, that I'm not going to stand by and watch a black female be brutalized. I'm going to intervene. Fine. He said, you should do so in a codified manner. And part of that is, hey, I understand. This might mean I'm going to die in the next 30 seconds, and I'm fine with that. No problem. Fine. As long as you go in having that understanding and whatever you think is the appropriate thing to do, no problem. But he just says situations like that, because you're not prepared, and it's not something that you initiated, that a lot of times we just don't grasp that that sort of thing can end up being a lethal confrontation quickly. So just either run. Or if you are going to engage in conflict, fine. If this is my last day on the planet, my last 5 minutes on the planet, that's fine. And I'm just not going to stand by and watch this. I'm going to intercede, and no problem. Whatever you think needs to be done. And keeping in mind what this could mean 6 months down the road, he also encouraged that as well, because the enforcement officials, when they arrive, they could decide that you are the one that is the problem and you are going to be the one that goes to jail. And that if this ends up with you going to jail for the next 40 years, fine, no problem. I have no problem with that either. But those were his 2 points that he did bring up when something like that happens, if you're making a decision about what to do, should you get involved, that sort of thing, for black people, non-white people, victims of racism.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Well, John Amos, the new show host, just played when Snoop Dogg was talking about the movie Roots. Was just a white.
Your line is not very clear. Like, I heard Don Imus and Roots and Snoop Dogg, but it's like, I don't know if it's breaking up or it's a little muffled. It's just not clear.
Okay, can you hear me now?
That's an improvement.
Yeah, John Amos, on this, he gave his 2 sentences on what Snoop Dogg said about the Roots. And what I wanted to say was that was just a symptom of white supremacy. He's in a white environment. He's a part of a company that is white endorsed. So one has to expect that when you are in an environment like that and you work for a white company, you are going to say things that is totally out of bounds. I agree with Snoop Dogg, because with the majority of slave films out and very little films on African accomplishment, that is going to brainwash the subconscious mind to think that that's all these people were. So I kind of agree with Snoop Dogg's perspective on the Roots. I mean, and also it is an act of terrorism, because it's basically putting your brutality in your face and saying, saying this is what happened to your people, and it continues to happen. So with all these movies out like this, it just does not help the situation. It just evokes more racial behavior and against black people, even with, the falsification of crime. Whenever a group of people want to engage in racism and they don't have no other way to do it, they are going to falsify crime or use propaganda through the media to justify their wrongdoings against black people. So the point I'm trying to make is that when you show these films and this is what other groups of people are getting when they are being told about a particular group of people, that is not going to give off a positive reaction. That's all I want to say.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, I wanted to know if you got the article I sent you about Donald Trump
making revamping and rephrasing his comment about making America great, and he added "for everyone." And in the article, they actually said he adjusted it so that he would not appear to be racist anymore. Did you see it, or did you get to take a look at it at all?
I did, yes, sir.
Okay. I just found it so funny because he's had, like, the most racist campaign I've ever seen in the modern era that I've been alive, as far as just the overt racism and violence. And it just made me laugh because it's, like, this far down the road, he turns around, and now he's trying to, you know, pander to black people in a way in which he never has throughout his campaign thus far. He's been pretty overtly racist with Mexicans and black people and everything else. So I think a lot of black people are going to continue to be fooled by him as he continues to adjust his racist tactics. And I just think it's too late for him to try and codify, because he's already exposed himself for where he really is for quite a long time. But there'll be quite a few black people that I feel that he'll be able to successfully fool with this new approach to making America great for everyone. And I just wanted to mute my line and put that out there, because I don't know if others might have seen or heard about that as well. Thank you.
That one's too long to fit on a hat. I think he should have just stuck with what he had to begin with.
I agree.
That's the winner. That's the winner. The caller at... Oh, I'm not sure. She had just dialed in, but looks like she might have dropped off. If you dial back in, I'll get your hand up, the caller that just dialed in. In the meantime, other folks who had a hand up, do you all have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
That's I apologize for the metaphor earlier. I didn't even catch myself. This is about the gorilla. I don't know if you remember when I first started writing you about workplace racism. I had a white woman, her name was Karen, at the job I was working, who said that her and her husband had killed a black kid. I don't know if you remember that. I delivered mail to her desk, and she said, "Oh, this is for me to pay these people, because, you know, we killed this black kid. And he had got electrocuted by a fence in her yard." Well, either way, when I asked her, you know, why didn't you pay, her response was, well, her parents must have been crackheads or something. And I asked her, well, you know, were they? And she said, no, we knew they weren't, but, you know, we didn't, you know, at the time, you know, I mean, why would you let your kid go out and play? So it just made me think of how that commentary went down with the gorilla. The first thing that they said was, you know, it wasn't like the parents was in the bathroom smoking crack. And it was just like how they always put those two things together when it comes down to us. And I'll meet my mom for now. Thank you.
I do remember that. The white, yeah, the racist that killed a black child. I didn't remember the crack part. I think you might have shared that aspect of it before as well. But, yeah, that's what I mean. Like, that's always just the assumption, standard racist operating procedure. Just black people, crack, of course. Of course they go together. Everybody. They're smoking crack and eating fried chicken, sometimes all together at the same time.
May I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
You've watched all of those videos about how you're supposed to interact with the police officers. And so now they have dogs here, and if the dogs smell residual marijuana on your money, they confiscate your money. Do you have to answer the question that they ask you if you have any money?
I think that, at least my understanding, that's a situation that I've never been involved in. And I've heard some background. I don't know if somebody has radio on or what have you. I have never been asked by an enforcement officer about revealing money. So for me, anything that is where they're asking about anything that I have on my person, if it's money, anything in my pockets, anything of that nature, it would have to be, do you have a warrant? If you have a warrant where I'm supposed to comply with being searched or you to search my residence or vehicle or whatever the case is, if you do not have a warrant, I am not complying. That's going to be one where it would have to, they would have to explain to me how I'm supposed to comply with this in terms of showing them any money. So if they asked me if I had any money, it would be, am I a person of interest? Am I under arrest? If the answer is no to both of those, there's nothing else to say. The other question, am I free to go? That's where we would be at. I would be ready to leave. If they say, no, you're not free to go, do you have any money? I just go back to the first two questions. Am I under arrest? If it's no, I'm not, I do not, and I just give them my sentence the same way I've said it before. I do not comply with any searches of my person, my possessions, my vehicle, my residence, wherever you happen to be, whatever the situation, without a warrant. I know you're just doing your job, but without a warrant, I do not consent to any searches. And that's where we just have to leave it at. I think I can't, unless somebody knows some aspect of law and it might change depending on the state that you're in, I would think whatever money you have, that that would be a possession of yours, that they would need a warrant unless they catch you in the act of a crime or you're going to be placed under arrest. If those two things are not the case legally, I don't think they can make you show them any money unless somebody knows something different where I'm in error.
So you don't answer that question?
I've never been asked, but the only times where I have been stopped and they ask me anything, I just said exactly what I just stated to you. I've not been under arrest. So then we're just, am I free to go? Then when I've been asked about being searched or anything like that, I do not consent to any searches without a warrant. And that's what I've said specifically when it's been, can we look through your bag or this, or do you have something in your pocket? I do not consent to any searches without a warrant, sir, ma'am. And that's worked flawlessly every time. So if it was a question about money for me, as long as I had it in my pocket or my wallet or your purse or whatever the case is, I do not consent to any searches without a warrant, sir, ma'am. That's how I would respond.
Now, I know in Jersey City, when I grew up, I was once arrested for standing in front of the store with my friends. And the law was, if you're stopped for loitering, you have to have ID and at least $11 in your pocket. And I didn't have $11. They took me there. But that was the law. I don't know if it's changed since then, but that was how it was back then.
Do you know if that's a law, like if you look to see what the statutes are in your part of Texas, I guess, to see if they have some sort of law where you are required to show how much money? That seems strange to me, unless you are actually committing a crime. If you're not under arrest or they don't catch you in the act of committing a crime, that seems odd that they would require you to show the amount of money that you have on your person at the time. Just randomly.
Well, like I said, it was for you.
I didn't mean you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. If you're loitering, that, you know, I can see how they can say, oh, that's a crime, you're loitering, so we got you. But, Karma, do you know about the statutes in Texas specifically, if that is a legal requirement that you divulge or you show whatever money you have on your person if you're stopped by an enforcement officer?
No, they've just been confiscating a lot of money, and also they have the debit card things now, that if you have a PayPal card, they just take the money off your PayPal card. They have scanners.
What's the reason for taking? I thought when you started, you said they get the money to see if it has any marijuana residue. What's their reason for taking it off your PayPal?
They say that you might have been involved in a crime, or you might have been speeding, or they suspect that, they suspect that this is you transferring money. What do they call it? Laundering money. You put the money on the cards and you laundering the money. They feel like this money on your card may have been obtained through drugs. So they have the new scanners, the ED scanners or whatever. And then they just scan the money right off your card. They just take it all.
Hmm.
And so I'm just figuring out, what do you say when they say, are you carrying any large sums of cash?
I'm certain a lot of it would vary in terms of where you are stopped, what the circumstances are when you are stopped. You have a lot more freedom if you are stopped and it's not where you have done something incorrect, where you are not under the influence, you're not loitering, as Thomas was talking about, that sort of thing, anything like that. I do not consent to any searches of my person. I'm not even getting into the details about how much cash I have on me or anything like that. Am I under arrest? Yes or no? If I'm not under arrest, am I free to go? It would not be a whole lot of discussion about anything, about how much money I have on me or anything like that. If I'm not under arrest, I really don't have a whole lot to say about anything. You're not obligated to answer any questions. So if I'm not under arrest, I don't really have anything to say about whether I have a quarter on me, whether I have $50,000 on me. If I'm not under arrest, you didn't catch me in a crime, I do not consent to any searches, and I'm not going to be answering a whole lot of questions. If I'm not under arrest, we can just sit. I'll just sit quietly, and, you know, you can decide if you want to get a warrant or whatever the case is going to be, but I would not answer any questions. Am I under arrest? Am I a person of interest so I can ascertain why I have been stopped? And then I would just make it clear I do not consent to any searches without a warrant. If they're going to go get a warrant to search me for whatever reason, I will sit quietly until they do so. Other than that, I would not have a whole lot else to say. And again, I would encourage folks to check the law in your area specifically, because I know sometimes I know it varies depending on where you happen to be on the globe in terms of what the specific requirements are in terms of what you're supposed to show if you're stopped by an enforcement officer and that sort of thing in terms of identification and name and all that stuff. Just check with your local rules and regulations that whites have set up to make sure you know what it is for your specific area.
Okay.
Any final comments folks need to get in before we wrap things up?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, I'm at work. I'm, you know, always nice. I'm trying to run to the back. In the state of Texas, I know that, because I live in Texas, that a lot of the time they're harder on crime because many statute of limitations, many of laws that was placed into the system, because Texas is considered a southern state, is more harsh on people who are in impoverished communities. So a lot of people who are from those communities tend not to do research on those kinds of things. And so therefore, when they are engaged in police if they are engaged with a police officer, they may not know the right things to say, and they may not know what to do. So in their mind, they get a little bit aggressive with the police, which increases their risk of being shot by the police, because in these communities, like we all know, they put police officers who are from predominantly white communities who already have a racially biased mindset towards people inside, people of color who are considered black. So I don't know. I have encountered a police officer, and, you know, I did use that term. Am I being arrested? And also, when they asked to search my vehicle, I said, I do not, you know, approve of any illegal procedures or anything like that. I noticed how the cop did get aggressive with me and, you know, to try and get me riled up to, so he can justifiably arrest me or whatever it is he was trying to do to me. Because when I was approaching the stop sign, I did not stop completely. I kept going, and it went from that to the point they was trying to frame me for something. So I did try to use that, but for some reason, I don't think that they really expect us to know to say those kinds of things, so that when we do say it, it do kind of spark aggression from the cop side. So do you think that phrase, I mean, that
does it relate? I mean, does it, you know, it varies from cop to cop? Because I do notice how some cops, well, hell, most cops who are white are racist. So some cops tend to be more aggressive than others. You know, and like I said, my situation, I did try to use that. And I noticed how the cop, he got very aggressive with me. I don't know if it's because he felt as if I was an uppity nigga, or he felt as if, you know, I was speaking out of bounds, or I don't know.
When I've used it before, and I make an effort to say it the same time everywhere, and it takes some practice even for me if I, you know, haven't been saying it, haven't had to use it for a while, thankfully, but I say I do not consent that way, because they can't just do it anyway, even if you say I don't consent and they just do it anyway, but just you can use that later on when it gets to court, and cases have been thrown out on that basis. Just the person said that they did not consent to the search, and that was not respected without a warrant. You didn't have one. But I have done that, and the same thing happened where they got aggressive. And a part of that, even we talked about some of that with Norm Stamper, former chief of police here in Seattle, where he said that's something he used to do, to get nasty and rude with black people so that they would then get upset. And then he'd be justified to pull out his nigger knocker and bust them upside the head or put them in a chokehold or whatever they want to do. And it's the same thing. You don't get upset. And I've said consistently, you're not saying this like you have an army behind you. I'm not suggesting that you did. But if they get aggressive or rowdy or what have you, and that's happened to me, I do not yell. I do not say anything else. I've already stated I do not consent to any searches of my person without a warrant. Sir, ma'am, know you're just doing your job, but I do not consent to any searches without a warrant. And they, when I've had it happen to me, they got, oh, that's what you're going to, and they just talk. I don't say anything. I just keep my hands still, sit patiently, and wait for them to finish. They weren't asking any questions. They were just going on their little tirade about blah, 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 blah. And after they finished, about 5 minutes later, you're free to go. And I just watched as I left so to make sure I could get out safely. But again, it's the sort of thing, if you're not comfortable, if you feel like, you know, it's going to counter racist codification, you are the person that is best able to judge your situation and what the best thing for you to do is. So if you feel like the best thing is to just, hey, let them go ahead and search and, you know, hope that everything works out okay, then that's what you should do, if that's the what you determine. But it, them getting upset or what have you, even that, in terms of just not being too surprised about that, because that's a part of how they practice racism. Even whites do that are not enforcement officers, just getting nasty and rude to see if they can provoke us to respond. And then when we do, then they can amplify and do whatever else that they want to do. Just about being codified and just anticipating that, not being surprised about that, and already having in mind how you want to respond in the situation. But certainly if you make an effort to do that, or whatever you use with enforcement officials, if you feel like it's not working and you just want to try and do whatever you think will be best so that you can get home safely and not be brutalized or jailed or what have you, make that decision and do that. But we had another person who wrote in. They said that they're in California, and they said that California laws, they legally can only do the confiscation and what have you if they actually catch you in a crime. When Carl was talking about, so if they catch you in possession of cannabis or you're doing something else with a crime, then they can do the confiscation and take your funds and that sort of thing. But if you are not in the act of committing a crime, that the same thing that I've been saying. I do not consent to any searches that they should not legally, they are not legally able to require you to show any money or take anything from you. He's saying he's in California. That's his understanding. Right on. We did our 3 hours. I didn't see any other hands. We should be back on Monday. We should be here early Monday. Our guest should be joining us from South Africa, so it'll be significantly earlier than we typically are on. It'll be, I believe it's 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. I guess for the folks that are in Central, that would be 2 p.m. Central time for folks. I know a lot of people will be working at that time, so if you're able to listen while you're at work, grand. If not, it'll be in the archives. But looking forward, this is a white man who acknowledges that he is racist and alleges that he is trying to work against that in South Africa. It would be good to have him on. In South Africa right now, they're doing a lot of reflection. It's been it's the 20-year anniversary of the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that they had after the fall of quote-unquote apartheid. So they're reflecting on that and talking to Desmond Tutu and the legacy of Nelson Mandela and, you know, what could have been done better. And the Kaffirs are still in a rather tough position here. And, you know, what could we have done to make things better? They're having lots of conversation about that in South Africa right now. So it'll be good to talk to him about that as well. But that'll be Monday. And then, as I told the caller before, Kathy Dang, she'll be here. I played this segment where she was on Democracy Now! Maybe a month or so ago, and they were talking about the case with Peter Liang, Kai Gurley, and she's an Asian female. She was talking about what the first caller mentioned, about how non-white, non-black people are used to terrorize black people, and that they need to speak up about the fact that black people, the darker you are, the worse you are going to be terrorized worldwide in the system of white supremacy. She was talking bluntly, explicitly, making it plain about all that and how those dynamics were playing out in the shooting, the killing of Akai Gurley. But Kathy Dang, she should be here on Thursday. Yes, sir.
Sorry, sorry for interjecting. I had a quick question. I wanted to know if you can email me the mailing address for the book, because I was trying to get it, but it's not allowing me to access your address, so I want to actually make your address one of my addresses, so anytime I want to send something, I can always select that address just from my account.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Okay, yes, if you can email it to me, I'll take care of it tonight, and it'll be on the way.
Grand. Much appreciated. Much appreciated. We'll do that afterwards. And thanks to all the folks who have invested in the program. Might not be necessary. I think someone already got it. I can send you the address so you'll have it, FYI.
Yes, but I was going to say, okay, if they got it, that's fine, no problem. But I still want the address anyway, so in the future I just have that direct access to send it that way. Because it doesn't always, when you go through the registry, it sometimes treats it as if it's a book that you're purchasing for yourself, which it did for me in this case, and it would not allow me to access your address. So I know the best way is just to have your address there, and I can select it just like any other address that I want to send something to. And I think that'll be just the way to alleviate that kind of aggravation moving forward.
Cool. I will do it once the program wraps up. Thank you kindly. Thank the person that got the book. Thank you kindly as well, and all the folks. It's been 7 years, and we've had tremendous support from folks, books and resources necessary to keep the program rolling. I hope the Cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If people have free time and you're looking for an assignment, and if you want to look at the laws in your specific area, just about if you are required to show an enforcement officer what funds, cash, or I don't know, I guess if you're saying PayPal cards or a credit card or a debit card or whatever other financial resources you might have on you at the time, if you want to look at your local information, that would be cool, because I'm going to see what it is for Washington State. But I cannot imagine that being something legal, and I keep saying legal because I know race soldiers. It's not like we are law-abiding officials of justice. They, you know, can and frequently do lots of things that are not legal, including killing a black person. So certainly taking a few, you know, dollars off of you, that's, you know, whatever. But at least just knowing the law, that would be good to know. I'm going to look and see what it is for Washington State. But I don't think you are required in Washington State. And I'd be surprised too many other places if they do not actually catch you in a crime. I cannot see where you'd be legally required to open up your wallet or purse or what have you and show what you have to an enforcement official. But anybody, if you have free time, if you want to check that out for your area and drop me an email, I would appreciate it. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. And I can post that video again where you can watch the different scenes in terms of how you deal with enforcement officials. Again, I would not tell you anything that I have not used myself. And I have used that repeatedly. It has worked flawlessly every time, even when officers have gotten nasty and rude, and I've had that happen repeatedly as well, and it still worked well, where I was not beaten, tased, handcuffed, nothing. It was, you know, an inconvenience for the time I had to deal with the race soldier, but, you know, just using words, being calm, not getting agitated or what have you, not moving around, keeping my hands visible. I generally raise my hands. I got that from Mr. Edward Williams. Raise my hands above my head so they can see it. They can't say that he was digging in his pockets or, you know, doing anything else. But am I a person of interest? Am I under arrest? If the answer is no to those, they have not caught you in the act of a crime or anything like that, am I free to go? And then if anything, can I search your pockets? Can I search your trunk? Can I search if they're at your residence? Can I come in and, you know, I do not consent to any searches of my person, my residence, my vehicle, my possessions without a warrant. Sir, ma'am, officer, sheriff, lieutenant, whomever you happen to be speaking with, say it with a smile. Say it nicely. You don't have an army behind you. It has worked flawlessly for me every time, including when the officer got nasty. I just said that and said nothing else. And then when they were done, it was, you're free to go. Thank you kindly. Catch you next time. But if you have any questions, I'll post the videos and you can check those out. Give some information if folks have questions or just want clarity on that. With that, we will be back, as I said, 48 hours. Well, actually, it's even sooner than that. We'll be back early Monday. If you can't find something in the archives, if you're looking for a previous program, if you have questions, gripes, guest suggestions, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Certainly, you can use Facebook as well. We're on Twitter at Until Justice. Thanks for all the folks tuning in. I will again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Certainly, bumping into an enforcement officer, or even just a regular old white person under the influence, can make that situation drastically worse. We want to be sober so we can make just outstanding decisions to keep ourselves safe. And just handle ourselves as best we can and anybody we might be responsible for at all times under conditions of white terrorism. If you're going to be in a vehicle, buckle up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.